Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Hi, this is Doug Podell. Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. Don't forget, while you're online, to check out the RIF concert page. It's the Motor City's best for complete rock concert information. For more details, just click on the RIF banner on your Windows Media Player.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the RIF's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Announcer Man. Welcome to the show. Pleased to have you here. And yes, indeed, in case anything hits you, something you'd like to contribute, something you'd like to speak publicly, remember the number, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. We're broadcasting from Detroit, Michigan, and streaming all over the world. Our main radio area is southeastern Michigan, northern Ohio, and southeastern Ontario. And Night Call brought to you this hour by Waking Up, Metro Detroit Sweatshop Free Clothing Store, located in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile Road in DeQuinder in Warren. And you can go to WakingUpStore.com. I reported last week about the successful environmental expo that the Waking Up Store sponsored. Myself and others spoke at it. If you have email, call talkyes@yahoo.com. Welcome to all the listeners in Japan. I mean, this is really incredible. Now, I heard from about five people. I mean, you can say you're in Japan and you're really in Indianapolis, but these folks wouldn't have any real reason to kind of fool me. I mean, would they? So what? Who cares? I believe they're in Japan because of some of the stuff that they've said. Now, let's look at this Hugo Chavez situation, where the only thing I would say, a good portion, I hope it's, the less the better, but the only portion of the Hugo Chavez United Nations speech a few days ago that Americans heard was that that Chavez called Bush the devil, Diablo. It was all Spanish. Then he was walking in Harlem and he called Bush an alcoholic, a sick man. He said, Bush is an alcoholic, a sick with a lot of hang-ups. He walks like John Wayne. He doesn't know anything about politics. He got there because of daddy. That's what took precedent. And I've been doing this nationally syndicated show the last week. And the one thing I said was maybe that he'd made a mistake using that language. Because if you look at the content of the speech, and you go to my, like before you get like real indignant, you say, he called him like that. I mean, go to my website and read the speech. It's peterwerby.com, peterwerby.com. Tell me what you think is wrong with the content of the speech. Now, the worst thing that you can say about Hugo Chavez is that he was rude. All right. So, but what's the harm done? I mean, why are these people getting how dare he? What are Chavez's crimes other than rudeness? And make an argument that people shouldn't be rude. Sticks and stones. That's what Bush should have said. Sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me. Or I'm rubber, you're glue. Everything you say to me bounces off me and sticks on you. But Chavez doesn't have any crime actually. But I was looking through all the material. All this material about Chavez and the United Nations and what have you. And at the end of this Associated Press account was something very interesting. right in the at the bottom of this. And I'll actually, in fact, it's Bush should resign as president, according to Chavez. And since his popularity, what, it's maybe up to 44% because the gas is down to, at least around here, $2.09. And there is, I'll talk about that a little later, there is a relationship there. Prices of gas go up, Bush's popularity goes down. The price of gas goes down, Bush's popularity goes up. But anyways, here's this one sentence. Here's this one sentence in, at the end of this story. And most people don't even get to the end of stories, right? They read lines, particularly online, but even in newspapers. That's why you always have a summary paragraph at the front and get all your important information quickly. And then just for the news geeks like me, you then maybe have a longer story. So here's the quote. Insults increasingly flown between Caracas and Washington since 2002 when the U.S. swiftly recognized leaders who briefly ousted Chavez in a coup before Chavez returned to power amid massive street protests. Now, if you're hearing all this information for the first time, it's kind of like, all right, we'll do it again. So here's when the bad feeling started. 2002, the United States, George W. Bush's government, quickly recognized leaders who ousted Chavez in a coup. And you got to believe, since the United States has this enormously long history of overthrowing Latin American governments that they didn't particularly like, some of it sometimes instituting fascists, always supporting torture states, this is not unusual. So this undemocratic coup occurs. Now, Chavez has had six elections of different varieties in Venezuela, all of them very strictly supervised and a lot of observers there from around the world. And there's never been a claim that he cheated or that he did anything illegal or anything like that. There's no claims like there are against George W. Bush in Florida in 2000 and Ohio in 2004. Nothing like that. All right. So these fascists, essentially, and what was there's a DVD out called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, because it is being televised, but I think that's the name of it. But put that in. If you want to look for it and watch it online. It's extraordinary, because a typical right-wing fascist coup of a democratic government, of the type that overthrew at the behest of the United States in 1972, that overthrew the democratically elected government of Chile and instituted fascism there for 18 years. So this happens there. Chavez is kidnapped, and obviously these guys always get executed. This is what George W. Bush dealt to Hugo Chavez. So you think he might have a little bit of animosity towards the guy? And not only did he attack him personally, and even if you want to say, well, there's no proof, there's no 100% proof that Bush was behind the coup. Bush now spends millions of dollars of U.S. taxpayer dollars to give to anti-Chavez forces in Venezuela today. That's how our tax dollars are spent. Not on us, but trying to replace this government, a guy who calls Bush El Diablo, the devil, right? And doesn't use it for our schools or our first responders or anything like that. So why do they want him overthrown? Because Chavez is demanding more royalties from the oil that is being produced by U.S. and other oil companies that take oil out of Venezuela. I mean, the old racket in the old days was that the ruling elite got enough to live like the, you know, very, very nice, like the wealthy and the upper middle class and the upper classes, as they do Caracas. I was there and I saw those districts and you'd think, oh, this is a nice city. Of course, then you go to see the other 3 or 4 million people in the barrios and just how awful they're still living, even with all the money that the Venezuelan government has poured into alleviating poverty, bringing them doctors, creating food co-ops, starting new little businesses. And the rich and the middle class, of which there isn't much, they hate Chavez. And they're about 25% of the country. So 75% of the Venezuelan people love Chavez. I mean, I don't that they're, you know, they have criticisms of him. I do. When I was in Caracas, I took part in a anti-Chavez policy demonstration. Not an anti-Chavez demonstration, but an anti-Chavez policy. And you know what the cops did? You know what the soldiers did that were there? They protected the demonstration. Not like here, where the, you know, the New York cops or something like that would kick the crap out of you because you dared to exercise your First Amendment rights. And people say, well, if you like Venezuela so much, why don't you go there? Hey, you know, I live here, man. I lived here all my life. I ain't going nowhere. So what are Chavez's crimes other than he's rude? And I'm rude, so I don't have any problem with him. And I don't have any problem with him calling Bush the devil. I mean, it was kind of comic because he crossed himself, Chavez did. And later in explaining himself, he said, is it in this little one here? Oh, yeah, Chavez told TV and radio host Tavis Smiley in a PBS broadcast, I think it was a rather humorous speech, smiling. In fact, well, here's why he said he did it. Bush considers himself a god, and that is a terrible manipulation, since this is obeying interests that are against God. Since he considers himself like God when you call him the devil, it's just to strike a balance. Well, what's so terrible about that? What's so awful about that? You tell me. 313-298-WRIF. So, and here's some of this stuff. His political foes and fans alike condemn the remarks. Well, I don't know if any of his fans condemn the remarks. U.S. newspapers criticize the Venezuelan leader, and one governor, well, I should tell you, well, all right, I need to tell you this first. This is from the Los Angeles Times. The day after he called President Bush the devil from the podium at the United Nations, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez stood at the altar of a Harlem church and presented himself as an angel, offering 100 million gallons of subsidized heating oil to needy Americans. It makes us feel good to give, he told the crowd. The move more than doubles the 40 million gallons of heating oil that Chavez donated to eight northeastern states last year after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita devastated refineries and caused the price of oil to soar. This winter, the program could reach about 1.2 million people in nine additional states. Wearing a single red shirt, Chavez spoke for more than an hour at the altar next to a screen flashing the logo of Citgo. That's right. That's the gas station here. It's the only place I'll ever get my gas. What am I going? Exxon Mobil, so I can pay off their retired CEO's $400 million retirement package. Is there oil from Saudi Arabia? Yeah. Remember who was on the plane on 9/11? What nationality? We're Venezuelans. A Venezuelan oil company based in Houston. That's Citgo. It's partnered with Citizens Energy Corporation, a program run by former Representative Joseph P. Kennedy II, which sells and distributes discounted home heating oil to low-income families. He says, one day the people of the United States will choose a president with whom we can talk. You don't know how much I would like to have as a friend the president of the United States. So here's somebody that's talked rudely about George W. Bush, and on the other hand, is donating millions of gallons of home heating oil. Home heating oil. This isn't so people can hot rod around. This is so people can heat their own homes and don't die of the cold. Here's a so-called third world country donating their precious oil because they've got poor as well. So it's hot there all the time. They don't need, they don't need to stay warm during the winter. Connect that up with the fact that billionaires only occupy the Forbes 400 list. So for the first time, the Forbes magazine list of 400 richest Americans consists exclusively of people worth $1 billion or more. So how come the poor and the rich are getting richer? Well, it's called looting. The middle class has dropped over the last 6 years in adjusted income, average or whatever. And certainly the poor, there's been an increase in poor people, probably to the extent, if you use realistic standards, 75 million poor people in this country. And in the meantime, the rich, Bush's base, is getting richer. So what else is, all right, so here in Boston, a city councilor said he wants to take down a landmark Citgo sign near the city's famed baseball park and replace it with an American flag. Well, you just go ahead, you whatever. Given the hatred of the United States displayed by dictator Hugo Chavez. Now, what's in that sentence? For one thing, he doesn't hate the United States at all. He's giving fuel oil to the poor of this country. He says he'd like to have a friend in Washington. And well, how is he a dictator? He doesn't violate the Constitution of his country the way George W. Bush does. He doesn't violate the statutes of the United States the way George Bush does. He doesn't invade countries on the basis of lies and commit crimes against peace under international law that George W. Bush does. And I think I might have said this the other week. The media in Venezuela is the most hostile media towards a government than any country in the entire world. That's right. So this is in this dictatorship. And you know how many political prisoners there are in Venezuela? Zero. You know, they had this coup in 2002 that Bush signed off on and recognized immediately these fascists and these businessmen. You know how many people are in jail as a result of this illegal, unconstitutional attempt to destroy the legal government of Venezuela? Zero. A businessman leading it, who was going to be really the dictator, had to flee to, I think, to Brazil. And you know what he does in Brazil now? He's got U.S. money, yours and mine, and he's still trying to foment the overthrow of Chavez. And you pick up the papers there, as I did, like El Nacional, and I don't know very much Spanish, but I know I can read what's in there a little bit, and other people translate it. Every charge, let me put it this way. I mean, because we could evaluate what their charges are. But there's certainly no restrictions on the press whatsoever. Are there right-wing demonstrations or anti-Chavez demonstrations as opposed to anti-Chavez policy demonstrations that I took part in? They have big ones sometimes. Because those middle-class, essentially European ancestry Venezuelans, they're mad. There are millions of poor people in the city of Caracas, where I was for a week. And they've got this beautiful golf course right in the middle of it. So the mayor of Caracas is, they're taking it over. I guess they're going to pay the people for it, and they're going to build housing for the poor. Well, God, they are outraged. We were up in this wealthy area. What was it Altamont? No. Can't remember what it was. Something like that. One of you can find me. We were eating in this restaurant, and this man came up. I had a badge on because I was there, on press credentials, and said Prensa Press. And he said, "Do you keep in mind?" And I said, "Yes, and I do. I don't trust any government, by the way. So I'm not gonna be this big Chavezista or anything like that." And he said, "We're I don't know who the we was. Maybe it was the non-Indian people of Venezuela." He said, "We're like the Jews in Germany." I said, "Oh, what is there, mobs going down the street and breaking windows?" "No." And I said, "What are they, concentration camp?" "No." You know, I said, do they break up your rallies?" And so I think what it was is he claimed, it could be. I mean, governments are nasty towards their opponents. Look at this one, spying on us and all that. He had lost a job at the University of Venezuela in Caracas. And it's weird because the university, because it's mostly upper class that go there up till recently, that's one of the things pissed at as well, is that now you can you don't go there just because you have the money to go there, like in this country. Now they, like for medical school, they have a lottery among all the people, so they get a lot of people from the poor barrios that are in there as well. So they're totally pissed at this. Wait a minute, man. That's our spots. We're the white wealthy people here. It should all go to us. So it seems strange that of all the conservative anti-Chavez professors, this was the one guy that got canned. Anyways, but for all I know, it could happen. Governments are pretty pissy about people messing with them. All right. And as always, the best defense against libel or slander is truth. Now, one of the things, of course, that Chavez said at the United Nations, he said, "The devil came here yesterday, right here." And there are people laughing and applauding, the delegates, other countries. And he said, "It smells of sulfur still today. This table that I'm now sitting in front of, it smells of sulfur." Well, that's totally slanderous. But Bush is a big farter. And I mean, you think, wow, what was this guy talking about? This is from the U.S. News and World Report. I might have even read this a couple of weeks ago because it's from August 20th. This is from Washington Whispers, Animal House in the West Wing. He loves to cuss, gets a jolly when a mountain biker wipes out trying to keep up with him. And now we're learning that the first frat boy loves flatulence jokes. A top insider let that slip when explaining why President Bush is paranoid around women, always worried about his behavior. But he's still a funny, earthy guy who, for example, can't get enough of fart jokes. He's also known to cut a few for laughs, especially when greeting new young aides. But forget about getting people to gas up at that. So here, we're talking about the behavior of the president of Venezuela in being rude, and we have the president of the United States laying farts in front of new interns. And if, I mean, besides just being this repulsive rich frat boy, it's also this kind of arrogance and power. I mean, can you imagine a new aide coming in front of some executive and doing the same thing? So tell me where the harm is here. How has the United States been harmed? And also the other thing that's absolutely, in some ways, the best thing about his speech, besides, yeah, his content. I mean, he laid it out about the U.S. trying to run the world. And it ain't working well. I mean, all you got to do is look at Iraq. But also, he recommended and held up a book by Noam Chomsky, C-H-O-M-S-K-Y. It's all you got to do. Or go to my website again, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E.com. In the next world, everybody's going to be named Smith and Jones, by the way, so we don't have all this reading. And he held up this book called Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance. And Noam Chomsky, the only thing that was kind of crazy, Chavez said that that he wished that he would have met Chomsky before Chomsky had died. And Chomsky is alive and still writing. And he also urged to read Chomsky's book instead of watching Superman and Batman movies, which he said make people stupid. Well, it's watching Superman and Batman movies don't make people stupid, but if it's all you watch and you have opinions about the world, if someone said to you, what do you think about Chavez's speech? And you said, I don't know. I have no idea. I don't have any idea about the content. I don't trust the way media presents things. But all I do is watch Superman and Batman movies, so I'm not going to give an opinion. I really haven't read enough about this, and I'm not going to read it, or I'm not going to take the indignation of some, you know, media flack or pundit to get all worked up about, because that's always what they're trying to do to us. So, but if you read, and you, Batman and Superman are mindless activities. That's good. I always tell you, don't be involved in mindless activities. I'm sorry. I love mindless activities because it allows you to relax some. But if you only do mindless activities, let the thinking critically about the world, you know, have a little bit of room to make these decisions. Well, not decisions, but you know, opinions, rather. New York Post called Chavez Caracas crackpot. I probably call him Caracas crackpot, right? And it didn't really say why. All right, that's good enough. Hello to our billionaires. So we're a nation now. Not only are we an oligarchy, right? We are run by a few, but we are now officially a plutocracy. This word from 100 years ago. We are certainly and completely run by the rich. So it's the rule of the rich, and maybe one of these days we will just all fetch our roofs or something like that. Huh? All right, let's go to our first caller. Our number here, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. It's James in Lake Orion. James, hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
Yes, I was going to bring up the thing about, you're familiar with the Social Security thing that they're talking about privatizing?
Are they? They're not still talking about that,
yes,
are they?
Yes, they are. I heard this on another station.
Oh, my God.
Okay, and they're working on it. Now, the congressman from our district here is Nolenberg and Rogers, two Bushkos, if there ever was.
Sure.
And, you know, I'm not happy with them. And they're in favor of this. They were also in favor of shipping, you know, jobs down to Central America. And you see what's happening here now.
Yeah.
With a Ford plant closing, and there'll be others to follow. We have the GM plant out here in Lake Orion.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell the supervisor, Jerry Kwasik, over here, he doesn't seem to realize that with Rogers and Nolenberg being here from this district, that they're all in favor of working with these big companies to go down to these third world countries and set up their industries, and they'll make more money for themselves, and there'll be less workers in this country.
Well, certainly, if you go to Nancy Skinner's website, skinnerforcongress.com, skinnerforcongress.com, you can see where Joe Nolenberg of the district gets his money and who he's beholden to and how he marches lockstep with the corporations that are screwing us so badly. What's the deal with Lake Orion? Is it kind of like split between...
Yes, we have a district split. Rogers is in my district here. I'm on the east side of Lake Orion. The west side is Nolenberg.
Yeah, there is somebody pretty decent running against Rogers, but I don't think that person has a chance. Unfortunately, Nancy Skinner has a damn good chance, but she needs lots of people helping her out, and you can just go to skinnerforcongress.com. Thanks for bringing that up, James. I appreciate it greatly. 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to John and Warren. John, hi. Peter Werby with you. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing excellent. Thanks.
What do you think about the governor's race?
What do you mean by what do I think about it?
Granholm and...
Well, I know. And DeVos? Well, if you want a right-wing businessman that didn't manage his own business pretty well, there you go. There's a choice.
Yeah, I think that's a good choice there. I mean, Granholm, I mean, jobs just left Michigan left and right. I mean, my brother's sitting right next to me, and he's laid off. And
well, wait. That's nothing to do with Granholm. I was being facetious. If you look, DeVos is a far right-wing conservative and is only friendly to business, and things will only get worse under this guy. The reason that we're losing jobs is because of the ineptness of the corporations who couldn't care less about their workers and have no responsibility to them whatsoever, and they're going to start shedding workers, destroying lives, destroying communities. Don't blame that on Jennifer Granholm.
Well, I mean, she ships jobs overseas.
Wait. She ships jobs overseas. How does she ship jobs overseas? She's the governor. She doesn't have any jobs at all.
Okay. She taxed cigarettes. Raise tax on cigarettes, raise tax on alcohol.
I'm not even sure about that, but those are called sin taxes, and one of the things they attempt to do is get people to consume less. And, gee, I'll tell you, man, if they put a $10 tax on cigarettes, I wouldn't care. If you're still smoking, you're addicted to not only a toxic substance, but one that corporations make billions off of. And one of the ways you could stick it to the corporations is stop smoking. But on the other hand, Jennifer Granholm was handed a bad set of economic affairs by the last Republican governor, and we get this guy DeVos in. Go to my website and look at some of the stuff, or go to her website. All right, thanks a lot. Man, I mean, are people going to be... Never mind. Here's Stanley. Stanley, hi. You're on WRIF. Good evening.
Good evening. How are you doing, sir?
Good.
Man, I tell you, if anybody can have a drink on me, it's El Presidente Chavez. He said more in 5 minutes up there than anybody representing me in Congress right now. And the cold, hard truth is I'd invite him on any given day to my dinner table for supper with me and my fiancé than the President of the United States, sir.
Well, he's just, one thing, Bush is just this rich kid that wouldn't have anything in common with anyone from Inkster or Detroit or Garden City or my suburb or anything like that. He's what they call a patrician, remember, from the Romans.
Yes.
Chavez, just an ordinary guy that wound up to be the president of Venezuela.
Yeah. Absolutely, and what the last caller talking about, Granholm, well, she's got a whole house full of Republicans, and everything Granholm tries to pass gets knocked down by the wall. I call it the wall. But it all starts at the federal level to try and do something with the states and the union. And the man behind the wheel right now, Bush, he's not a president. He's the dictator. Bush is the dictator, and Chavez is the man who's being generous, trying to help out the poor middle-class people with no jobs. They're going to close the Wayne Assembly Plant, apparently,
sure.
You know, if Ford don't make that bid on F-150 for 07. And nobody wants trucks. But God bless you, Peter, and God bless Hugo Chavez, regardless if he's a communist or not.
Well, you know what? He's not even a communist.
No.
I mean, he does so much capitalist business. His trade with U.S. corporations is up by 115%. He does business regularly with ConocoPhillips, with Total, I can't even remember all of it. I mean, what he wants to do is change the amount of looting. In other words, it used to be that these companies would come in and pay some royalties because the politicians in Venezuela were in on the racket. And so they would giffy the European, the Venezuelans with European origins enough to live this opulent lifestyle, and the poor would get screwed. It was just like all of Latin America. And what this is why Bush Co., Bush Incorporated, Bush and Sons Incorporated, hate Chavez so much, because what he's saying, hey, you're taking our natural resources, and we want you to give us a better deal, because we're going to take all of this money, and we're not going to give it to the ultra-wealthy. We are going to give it to the poor, mostly of Venezuela, but also throughout the Caribbean basin, and also into the United States. Doesn't seem like a real terrible guy to me. All right. Thanks a lot, Stanley. I appreciate it. All right. As we go to break, a couple lines have opened for you. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. The crimes of Hugo Chavez. And were you offended? Tell me. And tell me why.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, commercial sponsored advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
101 WRF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Wirth.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. And hey, if you'd like to join me this coming Wednesday, there's going to be a special preview of the award-winning new documentary. It's called Jesus Camp, and it's a frightening portrayal of these evangelical kids are off in this camp becoming soldiers for the Lord. Ooh, very scary. And there's going to be a special post-screening discussion. I'm going to be hosting that, along with Shane Kopitz of the Landmark Theaters. So it's going to be Wednesday, September 27th, 7:15 p.m., and you can't just show up. You got to go to my website and ask for passes. So here's the website, Peter Werbe, PETERWERBE.com, PeterWerbe.com, and then we'll email you the passes. And that's, there's something else in my brain here. But anyway, I hope a number of you join us out there. I guess it's filling up quickly, so you ought to, if you want to go. And I think this is going to be the last day, or maybe Monday will be the last day we'll even have that on the website. Here's Alan Inkster. Al, it's Peter Werbe. How are you?
Good. Yourself?
Good.
I'm sorry to hear our press manipulator-in-chief bring out that old canard when he was talking about Hugo Chavez's speech.
What did he say? I didn't know he even responded.
Yeah, Friday. I heard it on another network.
Did he say, I'm rubber, your thing you say about me bounces off me and sticks on you?
That's actually older and more childish than that. He hauled out the old anti-communist canard, but... you know, Hugo Chavez is only allowed to speak like he did at the UN because he doesn't give those kind of liberties to his own people at home.
Well, you know, when George Bush's mouth is open, you know he's lying. And if you're just joining me, I'll just give like two sentences. I was in Caracas. That has the most virulent anti-government, anti-Chavez media of any country in the entire world. And there's also regularly... huge demonstrations opposing him as well. And I took part in one that opposed his policies, not when I was there, in Caracas. Not him, but his policy. Go ahead, Al.
But we don't even have those liberties in this country anymore because, you know, every time Bush comes to town, you know, you have to be checked and vetted. And, you know, if you show any anti sort of government or anti-Bush leanings, you know, you're barred from entrance and the protesters are kept off in the free speech zone, which is...
If you're lucky,
miles away.
Yeah. If you're not attacked by the police, I run into people. They'd say, "Gee, I really agree with you, but I'm too afraid to go out on a demonstration. I'm afraid to bring my children." Something along those lines. This is the United States of America.
Because you can be arrested walking to the ice cream store after demonstration in front of your wife and your daughter and your friends because you created a traffic disturbance by saying "honk for peace."
There you go. That happened in Ferndale. Al, thanks for joining us from Inkster. 313-298-WRIF. So to AJ in Detroit. AJ, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete. How you doing?
Doing excellent. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah. The only thing I want to say is that the real devil is Dick Cheney. He's the real devil.
You know, AJ, Dick Cheney is the worst president we've ever had, and Bush is the second worst.
Yeah, but we all know that George Bush works for Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
That's all. We all know that. And one thing I want to ask you is, have you ever seen that documentary, The Oil Factor?
What's that? I didn't hear what you said.
The documentary Oil Factor.
Oil Factor? No, I've never even heard of it.
Oh, it's on Link TV. I don't know if you got Link TV. They always show this documentary. They call it The Oil Factor. And they got another documentary that they call Weapons of Mass Deception.
Oh, yeah. That was done by my friend Danny Schechter.
Yes, and I really, really would like for you to watch this documentary, The Oil Factor. It will tell you the whole nine yards about what's going on.
All right, I got a couple for you. In fact, there. You know, if you go to, do you use the internet?
Yeah.
If you go to my website and just go down on the left side, my last name is spelled W-E-R-B-E, and there's all these videos. There's a new one by Robert Greenwald called Iraq for Sale. There's a documentary called The U.S. versus John Lennon, which looks very cool. And where was the other ones that I was? Oh, yeah. The Power of Nightmares. The Power of Nightmares. And you can watch that right from my site. And then there's Why We Fight, which is another excellent one as well. So there's tons of them. There's tons of them. Thank you, sir. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-9743. Here's Tim. Tim's in Royal Oak. Tim, hi.
Hi, how are you, sir?
Doing good.
I'm calling about like four or five callers back. A guy called in talking about alcohol, cigarette taxes, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
In a way, I agree with that guy. He's a little misinformed and probably didn't do his research. We could all probably do more research and more know about the government than we really do. But and to be honest, the guy's right. I just paid car insurance on my three cars, and it went up 11% because of extreme car crash coverage by the state of Michigan or something like that. Now, these things are passed by, I wouldn't assume so, and I don't know so, but, again, this is where I was saying I could do some more research, but I would assume these things are not passed by the conservative Republican government. And I have to say as well,
it has to be, because the Republicans are the only ones that are introducing and passing bills, because they control both houses of the Michigan legislature. I don't know. I mean, I don't know these specific statutes, and it could be that Granholm is signing them. But they are veto-proof. The other way around. There's so many Republicans that they could override her veto.
Yeah,
but every bill, if there's anything within her tenure, it's all been initiated by the Republican legislature.
I just have it hard to believe that a conservative House would impose something like that. I want to say as well.
Why not? Why? They're always screwing people. They talk about the rights of people, but they're always screwing people.
Well, here's the thing. Today's conservative is not the true meaning of a conservative. Back when a conservative is less government control, things like that, and today it's just not. I can't consider myself a Democrat or a Republican anymore. But here's the thing as well that I have to make a point about. DeVos, if you look at it, and you know they were making points or whatever, take jobs to China, stuff like that, right? But if his job was to run a business, right, and to make his business profitable, what, as the governor, his business is Michigan, right, and he needs to make Michigan profitable, and how does he do that? By tax revenue, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so just if you think about it in a business perspective, if he is or if he is not a business, if a great businessman, whatever your view is on it, nevertheless, he's a businessman. So if his business is Michigan, that's his job to make it profitable. Do you see where I'm going with that?
Well, I do, but as far as I know, he didn't do real well when he was handed. You know, he's a millionaire, another one of these guys that was born on third base and thinks he hit a triple. So I got to learn. Yeah, I have to say, I've been so focused on international events and the whole way that Bushko has been functioning here. I'm not doing enough homework on Michigan, but I've read enough. And if you go to my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, go down to the that little photograph of DeVos, and that has a ton of information. Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it. Out to Ann Arbor we go and talk to Alan. Alan, hi. It's Peter Werbe on WRIF, and you're on the air.
Hey, Pete, thanks for doing a great job on your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to make a comment about Chavez's remarks that the world is slowly waking up, and that he said that Bush would live the rest of his days as a nightmare. But I really do think that with the Internet and with news agencies being pretty, open as opposed to where they were like 30 years ago, I really think that information nowadays, like, you cannot deny the amount of corruption that's going on. And one thing I wanted to ask your opinion on is, because I pretty much started paying like close attention to politics after the 2000 election. That's when I first started college, and I just realized that something went terribly wrong. It didn't seem like America to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to know, with your opinion, have you seen politics, or do you see politics going in a certain direction that it wasn't, let's say, in the 80s or in the 70s?
Well, it...
It seems like things are getting worse. Like, corruption is almost allowed now. Everyone's like, yeah, you know, we can see what Bush and company are doing, but what can we do? Or, like, everyone's just turning their backs on it.
Well, here's an example. The last every Republican, except for Jerry Ford, every Republican presidency has just been filled with corruption, you know, giveaways to the corporation, these useless wars that just inks the power of the military-industrial complex. But let's take Nixon, who presided over the deaths of millions of Vietnamese and tens of thousands of our troops, all based on lies. That's a whole long story. At the same time, he was passing and signing the Environmental Protection Act and the Clean Air Act and what have you. Bush is fighting a war based on lies, where already, you know, some 100,000 Iraqis have been killed and going on to 3,000 Americans. I think it was Friday, was the anniversary of the exact number of people, Americans, have died in Iraq and Afghanistan that died on September 11th. But Bush, at the same time, is doing everything he can to repeal the Environmental Protection Act and the Clean Air Act and turning the country 100% into a racket. It's not to say that when Clinton was in and Jimmy Carter, that they didn't do the will of the corporations as well, because they did. And yet they understood that you had to give something to the people. You had to allow a middle class to expand. You had to give more opportunity to working class and the poor. And Bushko is on a trajectory to make this into a third world country, to the point where a third world country like Venezuela is giving the United States, as charity, millions and millions of gallons of fuel oil for our outrageously high number of poor. Well, they've also convinced all of us that they're so powerful that they control all the institutions of government, that they control much of the media, and that the individual, you and me, are absolutely powerless. Well, you as an individual is powerless, Alan, and even though I have a voice on the radio, which allows me to speak to more people, I as an individual are powerless. But the real changes in this country, particularly the ones that expanded American democracy, the abolitionists, the suffragette, the anti-war people during before World War I, the union movement, the civil rights movement, all of that, faced an undemocratic and corrupt response from the American government, whoever happened to be the power right then, and had to make the government and the culture give at least a little. I mean, none of those problems have been completely resolved, particularly the ones over the last 100 years. But now we're back under assault again. Everything from the environment to labor rights and women's rights and all of that. I mean, so these psychos that have control of the government now, they want to run us back to the 19th century. They want to let the market, control our economic future, which means our labor then is sold for whatever the traffic will bear. So where we've been able to bid our labor up pretty high so we could develop a middle class and a decently waged working class, now they want to throw it on the market, so we will be competing with a Chinese worker, an Indonesian worker, and thinking, oh, thank you, sir, we're getting $4 an hour. I don't think so. But what that means is only through mass democratic action can we, in fact, let me grab something here. I'm sorry, I'm not giving you a chance to say a word. Are you with me, Alan?
I'm still here.
All right, okay. Now, in 2000, the election was stolen by the Bush machine. I mean, his brother was the governor of the state where it was stolen. His campaign chair was the responsible for getting people, Democrats, off the voting rolls and did that, for suppressing votes. And then when it still was up for grabs, the weighed in with all these Bush and Reagan appointees and gave the election to Bush. Now, Gore said, well, thank you, sir. And then he and Clinton went to the docilely, went to the inauguration on January 20th, 2001. In Mexico, it says more than 150,000 supporters. There was an election there early in the year. More than 150,000 supporters, which was more like 500,000, of the losing candidate, they call him the leftist candidate, for the president, flooded into the nation's capital historic square on Saturday and declared him the legitimate president of Mexico. As the supporters roared approval, the candidate, Andres Manuel López Obrador, the former Mexico City mayor, vowed to set up his own government and to fight against, quote, this is talking about Mexico, but it, could this be here too? A band of white-collar crooks and corrupt politicians who he said who stole the election from him. López Obrador said, I accept the responsibility of being president because I reject the imposition of their candidate and rupture of the constitutional order. They can keep their pirated institutions and their phony president, but they cannot keep our fatherland and our national dignity. They don't, by the way, the man that won, Calderon, where's his first name, Felipe Calderon, they do not call him a rightist. So, Mexican there is calling into question the ability of the ruling party to steal the election. And the Democrats just said, well, thank you, sir. So, after that speech, that's all I got to say, Alan.
No, I agree with that, and I think that I agree that we have to have, like, numbers. We have to have masses of people standing up. But, you know, the government does not want another 1965 through 1972. You know, they learned from Vietnam, and they learned what they can allow and what they can't do. And are you aware of the Weathermen and those groups?
Sure.
And, you know, they don't want another big student or young people demonstration and group getting together. So what do? I mean, everything that Nixon did that was illegal, all the surveillance that he conducted against students and all those people now.
Well, you can't let that stuff like that, you know, make you afraid. And the Weather Underground was an offshoot of this mass student-based movement of the 1960s and early 1970s called Students for a Democratic Society, SDS. And they have reformed. Of course, SDS was formed on the University of Michigan campus like in 1960, 61, 62, something like that. 62, I think. And so SDS is riding again. Thank you, Alan. Yeah. I got to go.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. So, yeah, check it out online. Students for a Democratic Society. What a concept, huh? Karen in Shelby Township. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello? You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
How are you doing tonight?
Good, thanks.
Great. I just have a comment to make. I think you're doing an excellent job, and I would like to know why you're not on more often and, like, earlier in the day.
Oh, I appreciate that, and that's meant, I know, as a high compliment. But you know what? And I'm sure somebody listening could say it's sour grapes, but I am perfectly happy right where I am. My life is in perfect balance right now, and it's okay. But I actually do some nationally syndicated work as well. And do you have Internet access?
Yes, I do.
Then did you, my last name, W-E-R-B-E? .com. If you go to that, you'll see where else I broadcast.
Okay.
Yeah. Is that it?
Well, that's it. I just think you're doing a great job, and I just hope that enough people are hearing you.
Well, I hope so, too. And because of Internet services like radiopower.org, the fact that WRIF sets it up as a podcast, whiterosesociety.org archives this. This is really heard all over the world, so you know, that's one of the reasons I'm so satisfied. Those two websites, particularly, and the people here at WRIF who are so great to me, making this program available not just live, but also making it available as a podcast, do a great service to me, and I hope to other people as well. And it's another thing, if you go to that website, which I've said about 20 times tonight, I think this is on the air. Wait a minute, I can actually go here. Yeah, at top, there are these little buttons, and if you go to on the air, it'll tell you all the places you can hear the show. So, thank you so much, Karen. Appreciate your call.
Okay.
All right. Good night. And we'll be right back. You want to call in the meantime, that means a line opened up, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Far away, leave me.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. This hour of Night Call brought to you by Waking Up, Metro Detroit Sweatshop Free Clothing Store located in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile Road in DeQuinder and Warren. You can go to wakingupstore.com. Lots of good stuff, or some of you remember, have now the Fifth Estate newspaper, now a magazine. Oil slumping below $60 a gallon, just going down and down and down. When I came in, it was $209. Who knows? Might even slip below $2. And there is a interview on my site. Doug Henwood, who is the publisher and editor of Left Business Journal. Wait, that's not the name. What is it? Can't remember what the hell the name of it is all of a sudden. Why doesn't it say in here? Oh, yeah. Left Business Observer. Left Business Observer. So it's a little technical. Doug, I've interviewed him before in the program, and he's kind of like a economic policy wonk from the left. He says the relation between Bush's approval ratings and the price of gas has a correlation. When the price of gas goes up, Bush's approval goes down, and vice versa. If the relation continues to hold, then if gas goes below $2 a gallon, then Bush's approval rating could go to 50% or more. So the common wisdom is at if you're pumping gas, prices, remember, it was like 3 1/4. It's down. It went down a dollar and a quarter. Remember, they were telling it's going to be at 4 or 5. People were saying $6 a gallon. Bush's popularity was really down the tubes. Now, this is InfoShop News, and they ask him, some are speculating that political shenanigans by Republicans could be responsible for the drop in oil prices. Is this kind of tampering even possible other than the usual amount of capitalist intervention in the market? What factors are really responsible for the drop in gas prices? So Doug Henwood, who's very critical of Bush, says, it's very hard for them to manipulate the price of gas, which generally moves with the price of oil. The energy markets are huge and filled with lots of non-Americans who have little interest in our midterm election. A lot of the run-up in the oil prices over the last few years was based on fundamentals, strong growth in Chinese demand, a lot of this stuff like that. But that's not all. Professional speculators like hedge funds and the big Wall Street houses have gotten into the act as well. When speculators move, they tend to move as a herd, so everybody in the game was loading up on so-called energy complex, oil, gasoline, natural gas. As with all speculative markets, though, even though trends usually go further and for longer, they go on for longer than seems rational. When they break, they can break big. Of course, all these price gyrations are perfect examples of the lunacy of capitalist markets, because the initial purpose of the stock market was to fund large enterprises. So someone had an idea to create a factory, but they didn't have enough capital. So they capitalized it by stock. You give them money against future profits. And it seemed like a good idea. It worked for a long time. And I forgot what it was. Don't hold me to this. Maybe someone has exact figures. But 50, 100 years ago, something like 10% of the market was speculative capital. And the rest was, what's the other word for it now? Was the funding of businesses. There's a special word for it. I can't remember. It's the op now. So the stock market is this enormous crap game, crap shoot. And the big losers are always the common people, whether it's when an economy goes bust in another part of the world, or when you or I lose something like Enron. Remember Enron? I almost couldn't think of it for a minute. This crapshoot winds up creeping out for the ordinary stockholder. Richies, of course, they always come up smelling like a rose. Like now, they're talking about all these housing rates are going up, particularly on adjustable rates. And this is really screwing the homeowner, of course, the people lending the money. They're doing all the better. That's why, for the first time, the Forbes magazine list of the 400 richest Americans is consisting exclusively of people worth $1 billion or more. In fact, these 400 people are worth $1.13 trillion, whereas a lot of the people we know are trying to figure out, can they get the shoes our kid, and at the same time, can they do whatever the other thing they have to do is. All right, let's go back to our phones, which are 313-298-WRIF and 313-298-9743. We're talking quite a bit, although not exclusively, about Hugo Chavez's speech and the man himself. I was asking, what harm actually has he done, and what are his crimes? No one's really come up with that, and actually the few remarks that Bush has made are, or John Bolton, the ambassador of the United Nations, pretty much just lies. In fact, Bolton's a good example. Bush couldn't get his nomination through the Congress. And that's part of the Constitution, that these appointments have to be made with the advice and consent of the Congress. That's rooted right in the Congress. So when something like this occurs, it has to be approved by the Congress. The Congress wouldn't approve it, so Bush just appointed him. So who's the dictator? Who's shredding their Constitution? I think that's a question that we want to ask. Oh, yeah, one more thing, and we go to the back to the phones here. And that is Wednesday night I'm going to be hosting a discussion following the film Jesus Camp. And Jesus Camp is this look at this camp for evangelical kids, Soldiers for the Lord. Very frightening to me. And you come see it and you tell me. But you can't just show up. It's going to be Wednesday, September 27th at the main art theater in Royal Oak. And so you have it on my site, and then you have to go to the email address that's on there. So I'm at Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. All right, enough of that. Let's go to Billy. Billy's in Clarkston. Hey, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Doing good, thanks.
I just want to say, in regards to the comments that Chavez made and, you know, the feeling of outrage that some people might have, I think a lot of that has to do with the way that the administration, you know, the Bush administration has painted the view in this country of what's patriotic and what's non-patriotic. Like, if you look at, you know, the Patriot Act, you know, something that does take away, you know, liberties that are supposed to be given to citizens of this country, you know, and like the way when Bush addressed it, something that really infuriated me was when he gave his address on 9/11, you know, a few weeks ago. It went from him talking about, you know, remember the people that died and whatnot, and then it turned into a, you know, support my decisions speech. And it just kind of seemed like certain things like 9/11 have caused Bush to kind of come out and use it as an excuse to support decisions that I think clearly show that he had an agenda before that even started.
Now, tell you, Billy, you talk about outrage. I was just outraged by that speech because it turned into, obviously, a political reelection speech for the term campaigns for the Republicans, because they decided way back in July that they were going to place the whole idea of security front and center. So the kind of grief and anger and the other emotions that all of us had after 9/11 were just manipulated. In fact, if you think about it, publicly, although there were observances at local churches and community centers and people, like I said, people in my neighborhood just walk around the block each year with candles and experience that grief person to person. But publicly, the grief is organized as TV viewers for lying documentaries or docudramas. Docudramas. Fodder for a Republican campaign. Doesn't make you want to express or publicly very much. All right, Billy, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let me get some of these ones, Al, that are a little far away, so we're not running up their bill too much. Here's Teresa in Ann Arbor. Teresa, hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hello?
Let's see. You're not Teresa, are you?
I'm her. She gave the phone to me. I'm her boyfriend. I'm Dan.
Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Boyfriend of Teresa. You're on the air.
She's not on, but I am. I'd like to say, you know, Chavez, he never did nothing. And, you know, the Bush administration, he's pretty, you know, they're awful, you know, in what they're saying about Bush, you know, and you got people like, you know, Hugo Chavez. I mean, not Hugo, you know what I mean? You got people like, whatchamacallit, Pat Robertson that want to assassinate him, and that's awful.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd also like to say about the war in Afghanistan and in Iraq, they never, you know, one thing that they could go to is, you ever heard of a group called RAWA?
Yes. In fact, you know, let me see, is it this week? Yeah, this week we... there's an interview with a woman who is, what's the name of it? Revolutionary?
I think it's Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, and interesting that you should say that, Dan. It's going to be a little later. It's going to be at 1:30.
Can you talk for a second, Dan?
1:30. You know, Dan, you got too much going on there. But so listen off the radio. Say hello to whoever that was, Teresa as well. But at 1:30 Eastern time, the rest of you can do the math around the country and around the world. An interview with someone who was associated with RAWA. And actually, at 1 o'clock, I'm saying actually too much. Don't write me. Boy, people, I get the emails, people correcting my language. I appreciate it. The complaint department's always open. But... now, I'm trying to stay away from any of the crutches. At 1 o'clock, there's an interview with the co-director of the documentary, Jesus Camp. So stay tuned for that as well. Let's get Will in Windsor. Will, thanks for making our show international. You're on the air.
Thank you, Peter. I just wanted to make a comment regarding the Chavez controversy and misrepresentation in the press. I'm referring specifically to a column in the New York Times by David Brooks this week. He's an op-ed columnist. I'm sure you're familiar with him.
I never read him, but...
I do, because I read the New York Times. It's one of the few papers I can stomach. But he made a specific comment about Chavez's diatribe up there about referring to Bush as the devil. And he purposely stated in his column that Chavez would never allow such a comment to be made in his own country. And what bothers me about that is he's a political analyst, and he knows better than that. Like, that's just gross misrepresentation. He knows Chavez has opposition in the country. Like, to suggest that Chavez is a dictator and would not allow such comment to be made by such a well-noted political columnist, I just found
he's
disturbing.
Well, it's beyond, you're being nice. I never feel the inclination to be so with these guys. He's lying. He knows full well that, and as this is the third time tonight, and I'm not saying this to you, but the third tonight that I've said this, is that the opposition media, which is almost all the privately owned corporate media in Venezuela, is virulently anti-Chavez, that there is no other media in the entire world that is so I don't know what you'd say, anti the current government, bar none.
But a man who protects his reputation as an analyst to make a statement like that, knowing full well, especially in the New York Times, knowing full well that it's an outright lie, it's very eye-opening and enlightening, I thought.
Well, let me just tell you one thing. Life is short, right? Everybody says that, and if not, even if you think it's long, there's moments in our day that we'll never get back. And eating David Brooks or any of these people is a worthless enterprise. And I see, you know what I read? You know, I even know what David Brooks says because I read the letters to the editor that will comment. And I'm thinking, boy, why do these people must have a lot of time on their hand or something like that? And a lot of people will listen to these right-wing commentators. They'll watch these right TV shows. And I said, why do you bother to do that? And they say, well, I want to know what the enemy is thinking. I want to know what the other side is saying. Somehow, without ever listening to right-wing talk radio, without watching Foxhole News or even CNN or any of that, I mean, wouldn't you say at least I seem to have an idea of what these folks...
You instinctively know what they're going to say, but I guess the point is it was in the New York Times. I was disappointed to see it there because... I know they're certainly capable of bias, but they tend to be a little more balanced.
Well, they're not going to step on the toes of their columnists. And if you think of what Maureen Dowd and Frank Rich and Bob Herbert say,
you're right.
They are like spot on about everything. So that's their, in a sense, their cover. right. If you will. And also their editorial positions have, after being cheerleaders for the war and falling for the same crap that all the other, the whole rest of the American media did, the lies that Bush Co. put out, they now are, you know, they almost make like they didn't even, weren't even there for it. All right, thanks a lot, Will. Thanks again. Here's Derek Derrickson, Clinton Township. Derek, hi.
Hi. Fucked up Chavez. Where the fuck the hell happened?
Okay.
What are you saying?
Hello?
Yeah, your cell phone.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Flip it up. Just 1 second. Okay, hello, can you hear me now?
Yeah, go ahead, Derek.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry about that. Yeah, this is my first time actually hearing something about this speech.
Yeah.
And, like, listening to it, you know, very few people actually have the balls to say stuff about Bush like that. Like, you know, everybody's afraid to say it for repercussions or whatever. And I agree with what he said.
Yeah, so do I.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I think Bush is the devil, but he's...
Not, you know, I mean, not the actual wording, but, you know...
The rest of it, yeah.
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 Because this, the whole thing is, this whole country is messed up. He runs it like some kind of tyrant.
Well...
The whole war, like the whole war on terror, and nothing's really getting done. And, you know, you have all these problems back here at home.
And he's spending $300 billion on this war that just gets worse and worse. And now they're saying, I mean, shades of Vietnam. Now they're saying we need more troops.
Yeah.
And they don't have them.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
So they're going to put the National Guard, more National Guardsmen, instead of being here to help us at home during disasters, they're going to be sent off to Iraq.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. We have, you know, the poor people, healthcare and everything is messed up. Job situation is completely screwed.
Yep.
And, you know, he justifies spending all this other money for something that's really not even, you know, we're not getting any kind of benefit from it.
You are hitting it, Derek. You got it. Thank you. Thank you for calling. Hey, by the way, I forgot about this a little earlier. Steve sent this in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Now, this is not Chavez, but this is Bolivian, the president of Bolivia, Evo Morales. Evo Morales is the president, came to power on the basis of this mass movement that essentially threw out the old conservative parties and put in a man of the people. And here's what he said about what they have done, and Chavez has done the same. We showed technically, financially, with numbers, that he was going to be able to recover the investment and would have a reasonable profit. He's talking about these capitalist corporations that operate in Bolivia. They weren't going to have as much profit as before because the largest gas fields, the companies only gave 18% of royalties to the state and took 82% in profit. Now, that's looting. I'm saying that about looting. But now with the new law, we changed that around. Now 82% for the government, for the state, and which then is redistributed among the people, and 18% for the companies. Now 18% return on investment is pretty damn good. And Morales says they're staying. There are no problems. And from that large field that Petrobras is managing, we've already seen $150 million coming into government coffers now. So that's the kind of radical approach, but still within the context of capitalism. It's just that the equation of looting has been altered considerably. Here's Ben in Chesterfield. Ben, hi. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I was just wanted to comment on the whole Chavez thing. I think, personally, I agree with a lot of what the man has to say, and I kick myself in my own butt because I voted for Bush twice.
First time,
I honestly thought he was the best president. And the second time, I thought I didn't really want to sit all the problems on someone else's shoulders, and I didn't really trust Kerry to be able to go in there and do it. But, again, I kicked myself into my own butt.
Well, I don't know if he could have done worse. I mean, I held my nose, to tell you the truth, and vote Kerry. It was mostly a vote against Bush. But he couldn't have done worse. It couldn't have done worse.
I don't know.
Well, yeah, go ahead.
It frustrates me a lot when I hear people discuss the issues of the world and the issues of our government. I know recently our electoral process has been marred and dirty, but it means a lot to me to vote. And people who don't vote and still have comments on the world really frustrate me.
Well, and usually, I mean, it's interesting that they've done this poll that shows that there is this even split between expected voters, people they expect to vote, and that's not the right word, but the people they expect to vote, it's like 48% for the Democrats, 48% for the Republicans. Among registered voters, it's like 52% for the Democrats and 42% for the Republicans, which means a lot of people ain't voting, just like you said. Thank you, sir. Thanks for having joined us. And let's go to Frank. Frank is in Ann Arbor. A lot of people from Ann Arbor tonight. Welcome, Frank.
Hi, Peter. Great show.
Thank you.
What do you think about Jerry Falwell saying that Hillary's worse than Lucifer?
Did he say that?
Yeah.
You know what? I was doing this national show this week, this nationally syndicated show, and I said, well, maybe that just didn't do a service to the points he was trying to get across, because the only thing that they paid attention to was him saying that the devil, that Bush was the devil. And the more substantive remarks about the role the United States foreign policy plays and all of that got lost. But somebody called and made the point, and I agreed with him. Had Chavez not made these remarks, you never would have even heard the speech at all. Instead, millions of people are here and around the world are reading his speech. It's on my website. And hundreds of thousands of people are checking out the book he recommended by Noam Chomsky. In fact, the Noam Chomsky book that Chavez recommended has gone to number one on the Amazon bestseller list. And, well, so what am I saying? So, what's his name? Falwell knows the same thing. All you got to do is say the most outrageous things in the world, and there you are on the front page, right?
Yeah, well, I think these religious ought to keep track of where their tithings are going, you know?
Well, I think the people that are giving to Jerry Falwell know exactly where they're going. I just wonder how the hell this guy can keep a tax-exempt status.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure, but you have a good evening.
Hey, thanks a lot, Frank. And here's somebody that goes back to the dawn of night call. It's Watts in Detroit.
Hi, Peter.
How you doing?
All right, thanks. First of all, I just want to give a quick shout-out to our own Detroit Tigers for finally making the playoffs in 19 years.
I was going to just say, I thought 18. 19 it is?
Yeah, well, 87, wow. I said.
Wow. Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I heard a bit of Senator Carl Levin a couple weeks ago on PBS having great examples about how unfair our fair trade is, and he went on to say that we need a program like JFK did with the Moon Project, and he said some great things, and he really wants an Apollo-like project for jobs and the economy. And so I don't know, you know, if you know anything more about it, it'd be great to hear through you, and maybe even interview him. He sounded really—he really had some great examples.
Yeah, no, I'm actually not familiar with it. I'll check it out.
Okay, thanks very much.
All right.
Show, man.
All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Good hearing from you again. Some open lines at 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Talking about the Republican, and one of these guys trying to buy the office, Dick DeVos. Andrew from Detroit says, I don't know whether or not Dick DeVos should be considered a successful businessman, much less whether skill in the private sector necessarily would translate into political leadership. However, part of the reason I can't vote for the man is his attitude towards the auto industry, Michigan's largest employer. His hometown newspaper, Grand Rapids, I guess, quoted him as saying that the auto industry, quote, should stop crying and that he's not very sympathetic to its problems because they are self-inflicted. Now, they are self-inflicted. But the auto industry isn't just made up of these wealthy stockholders, but rather the vast majority of people that make up the auto industry are our friends and neighbors, right? The people that produce the cars, that were the engineers, all of that. So he's essentially saying, screw them as well, DeVos is. And also, DeVos, is very close to this far right-wing American Family Association, and he supports the boycott of Ford, sinking them a little more, because the company has a non-discriminatory policy towards gay. And Andrew says, further evidence the candidate does not have state's best interests at heart. I would agree with that 100%, as they say. All right, here's Susie in Dearborn Heights. Susie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Speaking of DeVos, I wonder if you have
seen those commercials, those I Am Amway commercials that have been on for probably the last month?
No.
I have never seen an Amway commercial on TV before. All of a sudden, it's saturated. I mean, not cable, regular TV.
Huh.
With this I Am Amway, and it's all these different people that are supposed to be the average American, you know, everyman, saying, I am this and this, and I am Amway, and I've been working for Amway for 20 years, and my brother works for Amway, and they never mentioned DeVos, but this is just propaganda.
Sure, sure. The fix is in big time.
Yes, yeah. It's just disgusting. It just disgusts me. And then on top of that, I wonder if you've been noticing how everybody and his brother is all of a sudden saying Clinton is responsible for 9/11.
Well, that's to take the heat off of Bush, and I think Clinton, if you go to even any of the news websites, they have Clinton ripping Chris Wallace of Foxhole News, a new one, over that.
Good.
And I have no need to defend Clinton. I was never a big Clinton supporter to begin with.
But he wasn't there. He wasn't there when it happened.
Thank you, Susie. Exactly. The guard shifted. To say that Clinton was absolutely a failure. In fact, he said he tried to kill bin Laden and he failed. But he said he'd left them with the best security advisors and forces imaginable, and Bush and them did not even have any of that on the agenda. It wasn't Clinton who was warned a month and a half before 9/11 that bin Laden intends to strike in the United States. The buck stops where? It didn't stop in, it stopped on September 11th, except that's the way Bush is trying to play it. So, yeah, that's just damage control for George Bush presiding over the worst intelligence failure and the most disastrous occurrence in American history and trying to blame it on somebody else. But that's the nature of all of these guys. They screw up everything. When they're in business, they screwed up. Every policy decision they make turns terrible. And then it's always someone else's fault, and because of their wealth, because of their power, because of their privilege, they never have to pay the penalty.
But you know, what really ticked me off was that, have you ever heard of that show, NCIS? It's a regular show on, I don't know, Channel 16 or something.
Yeah, I've never seen it, but I've heard of it.
It's about the Navy, and it's got Mark Harmon is the star of it.
It's about the Navy?
I think it's the Navy.
Then I've never heard. No,
some
I thought,
service.
I, thought
I don't was... normally watch it, but there was nothing else on one day, and I just turned it on just for a little bit.
Yeah.
And they have this guy giving he's telling a guy who was not conscious during 9/11 what happened.
Uh-huh.
And he said it in this entertainment show. Well, Clinton let the ball drop and blah, 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 and then we got bombed by these airliners, and it's like, whoa, it's even in the entertainment.
Well,
they even somehow found some way to get it into these programs.
Well, Susie, you are convincing. I know you said there was nothing on, but you've convinced me all the more.
Oh, I'll never watch it again.
Never watch, ball games. That's what I like to see. And some, you know, I don't even have cable. I guess I'd probably watch some history and stuff like that. But
you know, if they repeat this stuff enough, there's a certain part of the population that's going to believe it just because they hear it over and over and over again.
And they don't have any contrary sources. If there was equal information, these people would disappear like Rumpelstiltskin. Think about this. Even if you don't believe, as I do, that the 2000 and 2004 elections were stolen, they were still so close that here the media always gave Bush a free ride and always gored, if you will,
gored
Kerry. And still it was that even if there would have been the equal presentation of ideas, these incompetent psychopaths would be back where they belong, which is in treatment. That's what I think. Hey, Susie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your call. We'll be right back to get yours.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hey,
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. We'll do this up till 1 a.m. Eastern time. Then our interview with Heidi Ewing, who's the co-director of Jesus Camp, the documentary that I'm going to be hosting at the main theater in Royal Oak on Wednesday. Go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B, Peter Werby, and you can get free tickets there. Thanks to Gary, who wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, so fed up, disgusted with the Bush Cove bandits, you're ready to scream? No more than usual. But he quotes Greg Palast, P-A-L-A-S-T, Greg Palast. You can go to his website, gregpalast.com. And he and Palast interviewed Hugo Chavez. And here, the Gulf, that's the Persian Gulf potentates, understand that in return for lending the U.S. Treasury the cash to fund George Bush's $2 trillion rise in the nation's debt, they receive protection in return. They lend us petrodollars, we lend them the 82nd Airborne. Chavez would put an end to all that. He'll sell his oil relatively cheaply, but intends to keep the petrodollars in Latin America. Recently, Chavez withdrew $20 billion from the U.S. Federal Reserve and at the same time lent or committed a like sum to Argentina, Ecuador, and other Latin American nations. Doesn't sound like a communist to me. Chavez notes the Wall Street Journal, Chavez, according to the Wall Street Journal, has become sort of a tropical international monetary fund. And as the Venezuelan president told me, Palace, he wants to abolish the Washington-based IMF, with its brutal free market dictates and replace it with an international humanitarian fund, or IHF. And so Palace says, why did George Bush turn down your help for New Orleans after the hurricane? And Chavez says, you should ask him, but from the very beginning of the terrible disaster of Katrina, our people in the U.S., like the president of CITGO, went to New Orleans to rescue people. We were in close contact by phone with Jesse Jackson. We hired buses. We got food and water. We tried to protect them. They are our brothers and sisters. So here is the evil Hugo Chavez saying the people of New Orleans are his brothers and sisters, and that they hired buses through CITGO, which a Venezuelan national oil company owns, Venezuelan government owns it. They brought food and water, and they tried to protect them. What did George Bush do? Who's the really bad guy here? Excuse me, just choking a little bit. Not choking up, just choking. Here's Josh in Roseville. Josh, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going great. Thanks for joining us.
Awesome. Hey, I work like 12 hours every day. Now, I was wondering, what's up with the tunnels in between Mexico and America?
What'd you say, tunnel?
Yeah, the tunnels.
I think they closed them all.
Really? I just flipped on CNN one night and I was like, what the heck? There's tunnels.
Well, maybe if they're still there. I mean, to get illegals in?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. Remember I was saying earlier, we got a terrible connection, Josh. I'm just going to say this and cut you loose and you can listen more off the air. The 12-hour day was ended virtually in the 1880s or the 1890s. And that's what's become of this country under Bush Co. is that the 100 and, what was it come out to be? I can't even do the math. 120 years or so. 120 years of working class and union struggle to get the working people of this country 8 hours day and 8 hour and 8 hour day and have. And have decent pay and have the rest of our lives free to live with our family is going down the drain. In the 1880s, people were shot down in the street by the Chicago cops because they were demanding an eight-hour day. And now we're back to square one. All right, thanks a lot. Hey, by the way, what happens with this illegal stuff is that it turns out to be a big boon for Bush's buddies. So there's this multi-billion dollar contract that's just been let out by the Department of Homeland Security that will eventually cover the 6,000 miles of the Mexican-Canadian border. Last time they tried this, it was almost like a $500 million effort, and it says here in the New York Times, well, let me read the sentence. The department is well aware of failed or incomplete border security efforts, including most recently a program known as the Integrated Surveillance Intelligence System that turned out to be a $429 million flop. So, you know, so easy to read this journalistic crap that doesn't really give you a whole sense of what's going on. So it was a flop. You go, oh, see, government can't do it. Well, who was it a flop for? It was a flop for you and me, because that's $429 million of our tax money that was not returned to the states, the communities, our neighborhood, make these the good places they should be. Instead, it all went to some contractor, a Bush supporter. So someone, this music, what am I thinking about? That was a Freudian sleep. These things don't get lost in the wash. You know, they ever do that? You go, no, I just ruined a $20 bill. It's not bad. It winds up somewhere. When money is stolen from the government, whether it's in Iraq, all the hundreds of billions of dollars that have gone to hell there, or whether it's in Katrina, or whether it's here on the border, that goes to people. And it's not, sometimes there's little scams. Remember that? He found out that some of these people about Katrina were cheating. That, you know, that's such chicken feed. I mean, it ought to be stopped. I'm not trying to say that. But that is, that's not really where all the big money goes. The big money goes to the people with the big money. Last sentence, get this too. About $700 million has been budgeted for the project this year of this border surveillance. While officials have given an overall estimate of $2 billion, Mr. Chertoff, who, of course, is Michael Chertoff, the Secretary of Homeland Security, refused to put a price on the project. As inexpensive as possible, was all he would say. What do you think? Think it's going to be $2 billion? Or do you think it's going to be billions and billions? And still, people will be coming illegally into the United States. Because we loot their economies, and they make so much less than us, that they're willing to stay here. One of the things, by the way, increased border security does, it means these people stay here. They used to, like, seasonally come to California and Oregon. In fact, a lot of illegal migrants who were fruit pickers had this, like, seven-month schedule that they would go around, particularly the California and the Northwest, and then they go back to Mexico. Well, now they're not going back to Mexico because, guess what? The border security is too tight. So they're staying here, and they're getting jobs in construction and what have you. So they're sort of moving up the economic ladder. In the meantime, millions of pounds of fruit did not get picked this year because, guess who was picking it? Illegal aliens. And there wasn't enough of them that could come up, and there wasn't the ones that had previously, as I said, drifted onto other jobs. So it's not going to be solved. Problem's not going to be solved by border security. Anytime that the major solution to any problem is military or police force, you know it ain't going to be solved. Unless you kill everybody. You know, there's some psychos that want to do that. But all right, let's move on. Peter Werbe here with you. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Here's Dave in Lincoln Park. Dave, hi, it's Peter Werbe.
How you doing today, Pete?
Good, good.
I'm doing all right. I actually just called a couple times before, and I would just like to say that it seems like the solution, actually, you're talking about the jobs and the economy in Michigan and stuff, kind of obvious, is that what the auto companies need to be doing is switching, obviously, something a little more greener, you know, say ethanol or, you know, with some of the others, like the biodiesel or, you know.
What now? How would that help the auto industry?
Well, obviously, you're creating jobs by, you know.
Okay.
you know, and you were talking like how they need a some type of, you know, motivation that they had about the SPIT program, you know, the same initiative, that's what they need over here.
Yeah.
So,
as we know, without much biodiesel, maybe a little, hybrid cars, Toyota's doing fine, and it just moved into the number two automaker in the United States, because it has plants all over the United States, and that Kia is making this billion-dollar facility in Alabama-Georgia border. So,
and I'm about to get a Honda Civic.
Yeah, so why, and it's an American-made car, not union-made, but whatever. So what do these folks have that United States automakers don't? All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Al, I cannot see next up on here, so I'm just going by people that have been on the longest. Here is Mike in Waterford. Mike, hi. Peter Werby, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Been following you for a long time, first-time caller.
Welcome.
Number one question. What happened to your buddy, Mike Malloy? They bumped him off the air.
Well, I got to tell you, that is something that really is not an appropriate conversation on this program.
I was figuring.
Yeah. Hey, go to my website again. All questions are answered at my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. You can get it there. So give a listen there. All right. Thanks a lot. Here's Mark in Hazel Park. Mark, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, I do as much reading as I can. And I read a couple of descriptions of government, and this one article said that communism is when government runs business. Fascism is when business runs government. And our democracy should be somewhere in between, a balance.
Wait a minute. Run that by me. Communism is what?
Communism is when
government runs business. Oh, fascism is when business runs government.
Right.
Whoa, so what do we have?
What do we have?
Yeah.
Are the sheeple of this country going to continue to be scared by George yelling Big Bad Wolf?
Well, it all remains to be seen. I mean, I would hate to think it just has to do with the price of oil.
Well,
because it
the
just
people
slipped,
that
yeah,
manipulate this country, I believe, will manipulate every. They have everything to lose if things change.
Yeah.
Because they're talking about impeaching Alberto Gonzalez, Dick Cheney, George Bush.
You mean if the Democrats get in?
If the changes, you know?
Yeah. And for one thing that the Democrats would do is, and some of them have talked about, introduce an excess profits tax. So when you get these, so it wouldn't be worth the while of these oil companies to screw us so badly at the pump.
Yeah. Speaking of excess profits, does anybody even realize that our government subsidizes these oil companies to find oil?
Sure. Well,
millions and millions of dollars, if not billions.
Yeah, and
so we're paying them to charge us excess at the pump.
There you go.
I think that should be enough to piss everybody off.
Well,
that's
all right. But, you know, people either don't know about it, and they just kind of get they get worked up at what they're told to get worked up at. Because it used to be back in the day when everybody was all worked up about welfare people taking too much money. They would say, you know, these people are driving up with Cadillacs, you know, and all that. And then you say, well, maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But, I mean, you certainly couldn't know because they certainly weren't at welfare office and how many people in Cadillacs had ever driven up there and who knows who drove them up and all that. But I would say, well, whatever. Much more. In fact, hundreds of billions of dollars are being stolen by corporations. I said, what do you think about that? And they go, well, I'm a boat too. But didn't have any of the emotion or any of the drive behind it. Because what it is, mostly what we have in America is the politics of resentment. And rather than focusing on who's ultimately responsible for the shape this country is in, which is not good when you have 75 million poor people. in this country, and they have no vision of their own, how this could be improved, turned around, the whole world made how it should be, rather than one of poverty and war, which is probably the larger definition of it all. Have we talked? I'm sorry. We, Mark?
Yeah.
Did I
can
talk
I
to you?
Make another statement?
Yeah, sure.
I got a statement. War is corporate welfare.
Sure.
And welfare, by description, I think, would be, going back to poor people in Cadillac, would be money given out for doing nothing.
There you go. And, yeah, and this is, I mean, it's become a cliche to talk about the military-industrial complex that Dwight Eisenhower, the Republican president, warned us against when he left office in 1960. It's the basis of our economy in many ways. And so we have to find enemies to fight. We have to keep fueling these huge war industries. And the fear is that the economy would not do well unless we were transferring. This is enormous transfer of private wealth, what you and I make, and then our taxes are taken out. And rather than transferring it, say, in a manner of creating an infrastructure for the United States and schools, having free universities, with, you know, all university education should be free rather than costing people 20, 30 grand a year. The wealth, our wealth, the wealth we produce, the wealth we create each day as we work, is transferred to these corporations that are getting government contracts to make war. So you got one end of them, Bush's father's corporation, the Carlyle Group, that makes the weapons of war, and then they destroy like Iraq. And, of course, there's great corruption and all that. And then they hire these other friends of Bush's, Halliburton and Bechtel, and these private security firms, these mercenaries, to do all sorts of stuff over there and to clean up the mess. And that's just riven with corruption and things that don't get done. So it's a racket. It's a 100% racket. No longer have government at all. It's ruled by a racket, a protection racket that says, give me a third of your money and we'll make sure that 9/11 doesn't happen again, like we let it happen the first time. All right, Mark, thank you very much. And here, just stuff like this in terms of what Mark was talking. Four government auditors who monitor losses for oil and gas on federal property, Interior Department suppressed their efforts to recover millions of dollars from companies they said were cheating the government. The accusations, many of them in four lawsuits that were unsealed last week, represent a rare rebellion by government investigators against their own agency. I like the other word. But so you have Bushco here telling the government auditors, you can't get back the money that was ripped off from us, because they don't care. The department's inspector general from the Interior Department, Earl E. Devaney, told a House subcommittee that short of crime, anything goes at the top of the Interior Department. Short of crime, anything goes at the top levels of Bush's Interior Department. And this is not a Democratic politician. This is the man who is charged with making sure that everything is going according to law and what have you. The only thing I would disagree with him, I'd say that's crime. We're being ripped off. This is grand larceny. Bushco is a racket involved in massive grand larceny and looting. And we're many of its victims. Victims, of course, and losing their lives because of the racket in Iraq and what have you. All right, let's take a few more calls before we go. I might even be able to squeeze in yours at 313-98-WRIF. Here is John in Schwartz Creek. John, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on there.
Hey, how you doing, man?
Good.
You know, I got a shortwave radio, and I started listening to it a couple weeks ago, and I hear this Alex Jones, you know, 911 was an inside job and all that stuff.
Right.
And boycott Sitco and all that stuff. I just want to know if anybody heard of Alex Jones, and he's got all these tapes, he'll mail you about how it's proved to be an inside job. I just want to know if anybody's heard about it.
Well, I think great numbers of people in the United States, tens of millions of people, either listen to Alex Jones or other people, and not that many, not tens of millions of people don't listen to Alex Jones, but the people that say that, in fact, 9/11 was an inside job, that it wasn't a plane that hit the Pentagon or crashed in Pennsylvania, and nothing I can really put my finger on one way or the other. I'm not sure the official story holds any water. which ones do? I don't know. But why would Alex Jones say boycott Sitco?
That Chavez dude or whatever.
Yeah, but actually Chavez has been meeting with these people, these 9/11 conspiratists, and saying that he was going to launch his own investigation into what was going on. Alex Jones is kind of a right-winger, and maybe doesn't like Chavez because he's a left-winger, but doesn't. See, you'd think they would like one another because they both think something was fishy about 9/11. Well, that's all I got for you, to tell you the truth. But, hey, go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and go to the icon that says 9/11, and you can see a lot of that stuff as well. All right, thanks a lot. All questions answered there. Here's Dave in Waterford. Dave, hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Mr. Werbe, how are you tonight?
Doing good. Thanks for calling.
I don't have the answers for anything. I don't even have a clue as to what really, really, really goes on in this world, and I can't even pretend that I do. I don't even know that I'd want to tell you the truth. It's just too damn bad that things have gotten to be the way that they are.
Uh-huh.
And so many of us walk through this life on a daily basis with blinders on, not seeing what's going on or not questioning or anything else of that nature. So it's my opinion that this Chavez guy is a extremely fast-rising star in the political world. And I don't know what good it does for Mr. Bush to try and put himself against him or say anything bad or point fingers. And on the other hand, I don't really know what good it does for Mr. Chavez to call Mr. Bush the devil either. I just wish that they could find, and I know this is never going to happen, nor could it ever probably be possible, couldn't they find some kind of common ground? And the same goes down into a micro thing as far as here at home in Michigan, the state of Michigan, and we've got a governor's election coming up.
Uh-huh.
Can they not find some kind of common ground? I don't care what DeVos did wrong here and there and this and that, nor Granholm for that matter. I'm a struggling blue-collar guy who's getting ready to not even be a blue-collar guy, and I hope to God there's welfare because I might have to go on it, not for lack of trying to find a job.
Well, my
deal. I need somebody to roll their sleeves up and do something.
Well, okay, I'm almost out of time, so let me just say, yeah, they should. But don't be fooled by the ads where you got a man, running for governor, rolling his sleeves up. But that old thing of can't we all just get along, Dave? You know what? 95% of us can get along. And it's that 5%, and they always wind up being the heads of countries that have the problems. Here's Eric in Belleville. Eric, hey, Peter Werbe, our last caller.
Yeah, Peter, I just wanted to, share with you my support for Bush. You know, I mean, everybody's always hammering on Bush, how he did this and did that. You know, I don't see what too bad of a job he's done. You know, we haven't had any more attacks on our country. How soon will we forget 9/11 and what particularly happened that day?
Well, wait a minute. He was the guy that was president when this happened and let it happen.
Well,
he was warned, and he did nothing. The people from the Clinton administration that Richard, all of a sudden his name's right out of my mind, but Richard Clark, the National Security Advisor on terrorism, told him what had to be done. Completely ignored him. They lied us into Iraq on intelligence they fake. They failed to go after Osama bin Laden because they were too focused on Iraq. There's been thousands of Americans killed, 100,000 civilians in Iraq killed. They're going to want our troops for both places. The economy is only working for the wealthy. You just heard some of these people. We're losing jobs after jobs after jobs, and on and on and on. The environment is attacked by Bush. They've got his cronies in everywhere. Did you forget about Katrina? I don't know. I mean, I guess somebody's got to say. Thank you, Eric. All right, stay tuned. Got a number of interesting interviews, and we'll talk next week.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days, every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. City of Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
This is WRIF.com.
Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. Welcome to the broadcast. I saw a documentary the other day, a preview version, and you're going to get to see a preview of it as well, that was extraordinarily disturbing and an enormously well-made piece of work. And we want to bring to our microphones here the co-director of it. Now, the film is called, the documentary, Jesus Camp, and it shows essentially the youngest foot soldiers for the Lord, and it's at essentially a Jesus camp. It's run by an evangelical minister who sees herself as a preacher for kids, and they go to a camp called Kids on Fire. Well, let's bring to our microphones the Detroit area co-director Heidi Ewing, who co-directed the film with Rachel Grady. Heidi Ewing, welcome home.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I'm so glad that you're talking about our film in my hometown. It means a lot to me.
Well, and we got to do this. You know, Detroit's the biggest small town in the world. So tell us just quickly about your background, where you went to high school and all that.
Well, I grew up in Farmington Hills, and I went to Our Lady of Mercy High School. So I was raised a Catholic, and my parents live in Franklin currently. And strangely, my brother, sister, and I all ended up in New York City. I think my parents took us to New York one too many times when we were kids, and something about those bright lights that are just stuck in our heads. But I come back to Detroit very often and have very fond memories of growing up there.
Well, both you and Rachel also were the directors of the acclaimed film, The Boys of Baraka, which is a very, very good documentary as well. It's out, I believe, on DVD now, isn't it?
That's right. You can get it on Netflix or Blockbuster anywhere. But that played at the DIA last year, but it didn't really get a full run in Detroit. And I'm so happy that Jesus Camp actually is going to open properly in the city, you know, at the Maple.
All right. Well, it is going to open at the Maple, but I should tell people as we begin that on Wednesday, September 27th at 7:15, there's going to be a special preview showing at the Main Theater, the Main Art Theater in Royal Oak at 11 Mile and Main. And you have to have passes. You can get passes by going to my site, peterwerbe.com, PETERWERBE.com. All right. Heidi Ewing, tell us in your words, just give us the plot summary. I did a little, but maybe you could expand it.
Well, Jesus Camp is very much like the title. It's about a group of, 9 and 10-year-old evangelical kids from Missouri who attend a very extreme, quite radical summer camp in North Dakota. And at the camp, the idea of the camp is to get these kids deeper into their faith. And at the same time, there are definitely some interesting political overtones that emerge that are sort of influencing these children's worldview. And the film is, it sounds kind of heavy, but it's extremely entertaining, and I think it's a very, very thought-provoking piece. We really try to look objectively at this community that's represented in our film and sort of try to understand better, how they're raising their children and exactly why, because it's definitely unusual for a lot of secular people to see this type of intensity in these kids, this religious intensity.
Sure, even, I think, religious liberals. I saw it this way, that I would think that, on one hand, I thought it was extraordinarily shocking. In fact, someone, in the New York Times, he said the youngest foot soldiers of the Lord, people have compared it in viewing the film to Nazi youth, and yet... And I was shocked by a lot of the behavior that went on there, and that we can talk about it. On the other hand, it strikes me that the minister and the children probably be comfortable with having the film shown because it represented them as they are.
Well, it's very, very interesting because it's as if we made two films in one, because people have totally different reactions to it, people who are watching the exact same movie. We just had the experience last week of showing the film in Springfield, Missouri, Kansas City, Missouri, Colorado Springs, very sort of evangelical strongholds, I guess you'd say, and a lot of people, we had some mixed audiences between secular and religious, and at certain parts where maybe the secular or the more liberal Christians would gasp, there was applause or smiles on behalf of I guess the more conservative Christians. And it's really interesting. I think it's best to check your preconceived notions at the door if you can, which is tough for all of us when you see this film, because people bring a lot of preconceived notions and stereotypes to the table when they watch a movie like this, because who doesn't have a very strong opinion about religion or God or politics right now in this country? So it's not like one of those films about Mongolian camel herders, where you say, that's interesting, that's cute, oh, oh, wow, I learned a lot. No, no, no. It's one of those films where everyone has a very strong reaction to this movie because everyone has opinions about the ideas that are presented in the movie. And that makes for fantastic conversation afterwards, and even better conversation the next day or 3 days later, because it takes a little while to process this film. So I wish you luck on your panel as you discuss the movie with the audience, because sometimes people right after the movie don't know exactly what to ask or to say. It's got that kind of impact.
Well, Heidi, I'm certainly looking forward to seeing Jesus Camp on the full screen. I saw a screener, as we call them, a preview of it. I think I remember reading an interview with you where you said you genuinely liked the people that you were filming.
Yeah, I did. I mean, you know, in a way, you know, what's not to like with the kids, especially? I mean, the kids are articulate and funny and attractive and well-meaning and decent people. And it's very interesting because we didn't want to just paint a portrait of sort of robotic kids being brainwashed or anything. That's just too easy. And we were not interested in doing something like that or ridiculing anyone, because when you make documentary films, you have the ability. You've got 90 minutes. It's not like some crazy news piece in the morning on Fox or CNN where everyone's screaming and arguing and then it goes to commercial. You have the opportunity to go deeper, and therefore the responsibility to go deeper and look at the humanity of the people in your film, even if you know that many people will not agree with them. The kids are so interesting because they've got incredible raw potential, and that raw potential could be directed in any direction. And of course, it all comes down to how one is raised.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the children in our film, Rachel, she could, you know, and with under one family, she will become a missionary in India, and under another family, she will graduate from Yale and work at the ACLU. She's got no lack of brain power. So it was very interesting for us to look at how these children are being raised, because they're just blank slates at the get-go. And I think we forget how much nurture is involved in the equation of how someone turns into adulthood.
Well, I hope you don't hate me for this, but I disliked most of the people in there. And
even the kids?
The kids frightened me.
Interesting. Some people do have that reaction.
Yeah,
I have heard this.
They were, as you said, extraordinarily engaged, extraordinarily intelligent, extraordinarily articulate, in many ways way beyond their years. And I take that back to the adults who seemed personable, particularly Reverend Becky Fisher, Reverend Becky Fisher, who runs the Kids on Fire summer camp for evangelical Christian children. Yet it seemed to me to be just pure, unadulterated indoctrination into this far right-wing version of Christianity that had great political overtones. And even though they seemed, quote, nice, I mean, you've seen, I'm sure, the classic California Reich film.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Yeah, well, you know, they after you kind of got into their world, they just seemed like a bunch of, you know, nice Nazis in a way. But then when you thought, wait a minute, what are these people believing?
I have to say, I do get I get uncomfortable with the term Nazi and Hitler Youth.
I'm not saying that about them.
Right. Because it's just because that some others have said it, if not you. It's just, I think it's a tiny bit simplistic, but I know what you're feeling, because a lot of people we've spoken to also feel fear when they see this film, and fear of the children when they come into adulthood and they can actually, you know, make real change. And I just think, you know, our country is really, really polarized right now. And I think that they're as fearful of what they consider godless liberalism as we are, perhaps, of, you know, extreme religiosity. So I definitely think that there's a huge rift, and I think that comes out in audiences.
Well, yeah, I think the difference is I don't sound very tolerant, but I don't really care what they do, and I'm certainly not trying to thrust my godless liberalism on them. And I'm certainly
right.
You know, want to have space for, as long as people don't hurt one another. Yet they want to totalize, and in fact, they say that in the film about taking the America back for Jesus. And
yeah, that rhetoric is definitely makes people uncomfortable. And this is the thing. I do think that, you know, a lot of, you know, liberal Christians or mainline Christians or just liberal people, secular people, lots of people, moderates, also agree with you. They don't feel that nobody really minds if somebody speaks in tongues or cries dip, or I think it's not even the way that people practice the religion. It's just when there's a group of people that would like to legislate their belief is when I think people get very uncomfortable. Maybe that's what you're referring to, because mm-hmm. I think that, you know, there is that we're living in a moment in time in this country right now where there is a very, very organized, large group of Americans who, you know, feel that our culture is base and that it needs to be changed, and the only way to do that is through legislation at the Supreme Court and, you know, other institutions of American democracy. And they're very, very involved. They write their congressmen. They write the FCC. They work at the library. They run for local office. And they're actually taking advantage of our democracy, in the best way that they can. And what I tell people who have a problem with this or disagree with this and feel like we're heading closer to a theocracy or something akin to that, that the only way to actually do anything about it is to take a page from the evangelical political playbook and get as involved. Because, unfortunately, people don't really, half the country doesn't vote, but all the evangelicals do vote.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I...
What's a minority starts to feel like the majority.
Well,
because it's the loudest voice.
I
think that that's a really relevant conversation we should be having, and I hope that we do reflect that in the film. This fear, the separation of church and state, is then blurred far too much for a lot of people's, you know, to stomach.
Well, we have, I think it's very well said, and I think that we have the same, whoever, I don't know who I'm speaking for, I have a house in my pocket, but everyone has the same opportunity to do what they're doing. The film is the extraordinary documentary, Jesus Camp. My guest is co-director Heidi Ewing, and she did the film along with Rachel Grady. There's going to be a special showing of this, a preview showing before it opens in Detroit, Wednesday, September 27th, 7:15. You must have a ticket. The only place you can get it, as far as I know, is on my website, peterwerbe.com, PETERWERBE.com.
Can my parents come? I got to tell them to get on your website.
Sure.
So they can see it locally before it opens on
I think we can get them in. I'll make it a point. Hey, I said earlier that I dislike the evangelical adults the most. Some of the kids were truly charming, I agree, even when they said things that have shocked me.
Uh-huh.
But the what I didn't like about the adults, they kept reducing these kids to tears. There were all of these scenes where this religious hysteria just left these kids sobbing. And I kept thinking, I won't even say what I was thinking. I was saying, like that, because, so partly it's in that.
Yeah, it's very intense. It's confusing. It's astonishing. I mean, you know, this is the thing. I was raised in the suburbs of Detroit. You know, I had a Catholic education that, looking back on it, I realized was a much more liberal education than a lot of people that in certain denominations of Christianity. And my friends were Catholics and they were Jews. And I was never exposed to the evangelical born-again experience. I really didn't even know anything about it. And it's no one's fault. It's just, it was not very prevalent that I know of in the suburbs where I grew up. And so for me, church, you know, there was ritual. We used to go to Old St. Mary's, and we still do at Christmas time. And then they would go to Our Lady of Sorrows. And there was incense, and there was stained glass, and there were the Stations of the Cross, and there was definitely some mystery to this ritual. But there was nothing akin to what I saw when we started filming in the heartland, in the suburbs of Kansas City. And, you know, the tears and the overt expressions of joy and of pain and of sorrow, it was just so wild. Wild. And of course, the film, people who represent in our film are Pentecostal, charismatic, so they represent about 30% of the evangelical world. It's the fastest growing sect of evangelicalism in the world, the Pentecostal faith. And I get why kids like it, because you dance and it's really expressive and you can be loud and you can try to heal the sick and lay your hands on people and command in the name of Jesus that someone, you know, can stand up and walk, and it's a lot of action. So I understand the appeal of it to kids, actually. But I had never now I understand it because I've experienced it for a year. But I had so many questions when we first saw this kind of emotion. I mean, out of a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old kid, and I kept asking, but why the tears? Why are they crying? And what, you know, and one of the fathers, closest I ever got to really understanding it, was one of Levi's father. Actually, said to me, he said, Well, God's heart is broken for all of our sin and to the vile nature of our world, and so the kids' hearts are also broken. They share God's broken heart, and they cry for the nations, and they cry for the faithless, and they cry for what they call the 1040 window, which refers to the parallel on the on a globe. The least church or the least Christian nations in the world are considered the 1040, the 1040 window. So they would cry for the 1040 window. But it was of course very confusing and surprising to us, and it just sort of urged us further on to try to get to the bottom of this and try to understand. But who can really understand this kind of faith? Who can really explain away belief? I mean, I think a human being on the planet Earth feels the need or the desire to transcend this, you know, this mortal coil in some kind of way. And so it was, I never really fully understood it, to be honest with you. And that's why I think the film presents more questions than answers, because far be it from us to try to answer some of these deeper questions that everybody kind of grapples with.
Well, Heidi Ewing, I guess probably as a filmmaker, you'll take this as a high compliment. I was watching this, and over again, I thought, how did they get that shot? Wow, how did they get that? And maybe, because we do have a little bit of time, tell us, how did you, go up and to these folks and say, hey, we'd like to film you?
Well, we were looking for a film about children, faithful, you know, religious children, because our last film, The Boys of Baraka, featured a African-American 12-year-old child preacher named Devon Brown. He's a Baptist, and he was amazing, and was kind of finding a fire and brimstone preacher in the inner city. And he kind of stuck with us, and we thought, why is he so faithful and into his church, and his sister, who's being raised in the same house, isn't? What is it? What makes someone? So these questions kind of stuck with us and nagged at us. And we thought, let's look into making a film about kids with this kind of fervor, religious fervor. And we started doing a lot of research, and Becky Fisher's name came up several times when we started calling around different churches in the country. We checked out her website. It was clear that it was going to be a very cinematic kind of experience, her ministry. We called her up. We went to North Dakota. We knocked on her door, and we sat and talked, and we told her why we wanted to do this and what we were interested in doing. And she was surprised that what she called a secular film crew would be interested in her ministry at all. And we told her we were going to give her the fairest shake that we could possibly give her. That's what I was going to ask,
that she would be afraid it was going to be a hit piece.
Well, yeah, I mean, she definitely checked us out. She looked at our films in the past, and I think she liked the fact that we're not fans of voiceover narration that the filmmaker writes at a later date. And she just, you know, no pun intended, leap of faith. And she is very much behind the film and supports the film and is promoting the film because she thinks that she's got nothing to apologize for and that this represents her ministry. She considers herself apolitical. The people in our film do not consider themselves political, which is astonishing to us because as a secular person, you know, clutching onto, you know, small plastic fetuses and chanting righteous judges for the Supreme Court is political. So, but the people in our film and Becky and the subjects feel that they're doing God's will, and if we want to call it political, we can call it political. So that was a very interesting addition. You know, she was surprised when the political elements came forth in the film, and we explained to her, you know, how we saw it and that a lot of people would see it in such a manner, and she was fascinated that they'd be considered political activists, which we believe that they are.
Well, also, at one point in the film, Jesus Camp, an unidentified woman brings in this life-sized cutout of George W. Bush, and they say, let's greet him, and she starts talking in tongues to the cutout. I go, whoo!
Well, you asked about the George Bush cutout, which I think the George Bush cutout might be the most famous player in Jesus Camp for some reason. We should have credited the George Bush cutout because it's so talked about. We asked them about that, and they said, well, we would have prayed for any leader. It's in the Bible. We have to pray for those in authority above us.
I don't believe that.
Would you have prayed for Bill Clinton? I said, absolutely. I said, would you have prayed to a life-size cardboard cutout of Bill Clinton? after the Lewinsky scandal. Before, after. Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, well.
But look, the bottom line is, you know, there is a very, very special affinity between George W. Bush and the evangelical movement. Nobody's hiding that. No one's pretending that's not true. They feel that they have a friend in the White House. He's a self-professed born-again Christian, and he is the most animated, I think, when he talks about his faith in God, which makes me think that he's a real believer. And so I think that the evangelical community has obviously noticed that, and they voted for him, and they do expect some things in return for those votes. And that's where the whole Supreme Court issue in the film comes out. I think it's all scratch your back, you scratch mine situation, and they don't want to miss this opportunity to, you know, reshape, quote unquote, the culture, and they believe they've got the right man in the White House to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's absolutely obvious in the film, and I think just generally right now in the country. And I think it's a conversation that people want to have, right now.
Tell us just some cinematic inside stuff. I mean, you had these conversations that these children were having among themselves, so the camera was there as the third party.
Yes.
And yet, it seemed completely, they didn't seem at all. In fact, no one in the film ever seemed, except when they were talking directly to the camera, ever seemed to be aware that you guys were filming. You would have thought that children would have been really self-conscious.
You know what's funny? It's quite the opposite. I mean, the kids... kids have short attention spans. They get very bored very quickly with whatever is in front of them. And that's partly what makes them great documentary subjects, because I think you get to the real and the genuine quicker than you would with an adult who's always got that sort of self-conscious, baggage, I guess I'd call it. I think as adults, we're definitely a little more guarded. And these kids in particular were strangely uninterested in us. I mean, I almost got my feelings hurt. I almost started to feel like, well, aren't you interested in me? And I'm standing here with the camera in your face. Hello, but they were so intense and so into what they were doing and so into each other. And, Levi was always, reading his Bible and trying to become a better Christian. And we were like a sideshow, really.
Hmm.
And they liked us and they were curious about us. But once that sort of passed, they never once asked to see footage played back. They never once asked when the movie was going to be finished. It was astonishing and almost inexplicable, because you'd think, these kids just lacked vanity. They lacked the kind of vanity that I'm used to seeing in even my nieces and nephews and other kids. It was fascinating to us. So I think we were able to get much more real material quicker because of that fact about those kids.
Well, you must be bowled over by the attention this is getting. The Boys of Baraka got just absolutely wonderful reviews, except like so many wonderful documentaries, it doesn't have much.
If only Boys of Baraka had gotten this kind of attention. It's slightly heartbreaking because that we love that movie so much as well. But I think you can't tell people what to be interested in and what to see. And I think we've struck a nerve, because I think this country wants to have this conversation right now. And I really hope people go see it and go with an open mind. And I really want people in the Detroit area to see it, because I'm from there. And, a lot of documentaries don't go to that market because it's a very expensive market. And Boys of Baraka didn't play there because it's very expensive to advertise in that area. And it's considered a tough market for independent film. So I'm so fortunate to know that our film is going to be shown in my hometown, and it means a lot to me. So I really hope people will get in their cars and will drive to the Mabel Theater and see the film. And I'm hoping to come back during the run and see how it's going.
And if a special preview of it on Wednesday, September 27th, that's this Wednesday coming up at 7:15, there's going to be a special preview at the Main Art Theater in Royal Oak at the corner of North Main and 11 Mile Road. And you can get passes. You have to have passes to go. You can go to my website, peterwerbe.com, PETERWERBE.com. And Heidi Ewing earlier in the interview asked, could I make sure that her parents get in?
I'll tell my parents they got to go.
They got to go. Heidi, thanks so much for being with us. And this, as I said earlier, an extraordinary documentary. I would suggest it to everyone. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Like a song you just heard?
Oh, yeah!
Listen up.
Then head on over to the Digital Riff Music Store at WRIF.com and download your favorite riff tunes for just 99 cents.
Next song.
Stay connected.
With 101 WRIF
and WRIF.com.
Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. In the speech we heard from George W. Bush on September 11th, he talked a lot about Iraq. What we don't hear much about is the other war. We know it's there. There's fighting in Afghanistan. There's casualties from time to time. But to some extent, we hear about it being the success story. That worked. We chased out these awful people, the Taliban, who gave sanctuary to Osama bin Laden, and has been replaced by a Democratic government. That's essentially what we hear. Joining me from the University of Maryland is Ann Brodsky. She is an associate professor of psychology and the director of the Gender and Women's Studies at the university. And she's been to Afghanistan 5 times recently. Hey, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
What has brought you to Afghanistan 5 times?
Well, I first got interested in what was happening in Afghanistan, particularly for women, in 2000 when I met some women activists from Afghanistan in the U.S., and I was quite moved by their struggle, by how they talked about the country, by the desires of women and the people of Afghanistan to be free of Taliban rule. And so at that point, I started learning more, started educating myself, and also helping this particular organization, which is called RAWA. And then it really expanded as I realized that my research is on risk and resilience and women's communities, and I wondered whether my professional training could be of use as well. And so that's where the book came from, trying to explore how women had really survived and some even thrived under such difficult circumstances in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. And I fail to note that your book is With All Our Strength, which chronicles the experiences of Afghan women. Now, the women were severely repressed under the Taliban. In fact, they had pushed back many of the gains that women had enjoyed under Soviet domination. Can you tell us a little about that?
Right, you're absolutely right. And the gains for women in Afghanistan had begun even earlier. There had been Zahir Shah had been a fairly progressive ruler and was interested in seeing the country move forward. He had visited Europe and had ideas about that. And even before him, there was another ruler called Aminullah, who also was one of the first to introduce them into schools and encourage them to be abroad if they could. And so there had been a period of time where Afghan women really saw their lives improving, educational opportunities, jobs. In the 70s, for example, women were 50% of the University of Kabul student body. They were doctors and lawyers and engineers. And so it came as quite a shock when this started to degrade. And, of course, war is never good for any people in a country, but for women it began to limit some of their possibilities under the Soviet invasion. And while the Soviets really pushed for faster advancements for women, they did so in ways that were really insensitive to the culture. Soviet Union's never been known for being particularly good at fitting into the cultural nuances of the countries they invade. And so, unfortunately, women's rights, women's equality, women's progress became synonymous with communism. And so when the communists were defeated, when the Soviet Union was defeated and left the country in 1989, it became a time period where those anti-Soviet forces who later took over and caused the civil war started talking about how, you know, women talking about their rights, that was really a communist thing. That wasn't an Afghan desire, which couldn't have been farther from the truth. So during the civil war period, I'm sorry, from 92 to 96, women really became some of the first victims of these fundamentalist factions who were fighting for control of the country, really destroyed a lot of the country at this point. And
this was both sides, too.
This was all sides. These were the forces who had originally fought to free the country from the Soviet Union, but they turned on each other. And so it became unsafe for women to go out. It became unsafe for women to be in schools, to be working, to be traveling without a close male relative, to go out without a burqa, because the situation on the street was so violent. Women were being kidnapped. They were being raped. They were being forced to marry by these jihadis, these civil war factions. And so when the Taliban came to power, while they made certain things law, like women couldn't go to school, they couldn't go to work, they had to be covered when they were out of the house, they had to be with a close male relative, these things had been restrictions that were really placed on women before that time when the civil war was taking place. And what's important to keep in mind is those men who fought the civil war, many of them are what we today call the warlords, who are back in power. And so women's concerns about their well-being, about their rights, about their safety have not ended with the defeat of the Taliban.
Now, tell us, you've been there five times. Has there been changes in the status of women each time you've been there? Has it gotten better, gotten worse, stayed the same?
That's a really good question. I was in Pakistan for a couple times in 2000. I was actually in Pakistan working with Afghan refugees right before September 11th, 2001, and then was back in Pakistan in December of 2001, January 2002, while the U.S. was still bombing Afghanistan. And there was a lot of hope at that point that women were going to be able to take an active role in society, that they would see their progress begin again. And right after the defeat of the Taliban with the new constitution, there were hopes again, and certainly women were encouraged to take part in the elections. There were seats reserved for women in the parliament, and women were elected to parliament. And women in the early days post-Taliban were getting braver and braver in some ways, going out in the streets, going back to schools, to work, making their own personal choices about covering, not wearing burqa only because of threat of violence, but if that was their personal religious choice, they would. If it wasn't, they did not. But unfortunately, what I saw in the last two trips is things going backwards to some extent.
Which was when?
I just came back. I was there in August, July and August this summer, mm-hmm. and before that I hadn't been there for 2 years. When I was back 2 years ago, there were beginning to be signs that people were more scared, that the transition from the Taliban was not going as people had hoped, that reconstruction was not going as smoothly, that while women and girls were able to go back to school and work legally, there were still concerns about security, there weren't enough schools for girls, there were still threats. This summer, when I was back, it was even more profound. I saw women and spoke with women who said that a lot of the gains they had hoped to make were on paper alone. There's not really the rule of law to back up what the Constitution says. While 23% of the new parliament are women. They're very much outnumbered by the 60% who are warlords with or have connections to the warlords, the militias, and really terrible human rights violations. If women come from educated families, if they're in the cities, if they have the support of their families, then they certainly have more possibilities than under the Taliban. But you step outside of the major cities and you see women living lives that are practically unchanged from Taliban time.
I remember, and probably other people have heard this as well, that after September 11th, when American troops were there, they continually ran into people in the rural districts, provinces, that had never heard of the September 11th events, had never heard of the Taliban, and had never heard of Osama bin Laden.
I mean, right.
Yeah. That, is there still that sort of, what would you, I guess, provincialism, the way it used to be called? That is, that the province are disconnected from the major cities.
Well, unfortunately, because the violence really has spread into the provinces, I think that most people at this point know what has happened and what is going on. I read a recent report from a think tank in Europe that actually, for the first time I saw, talked about a Taliban front line and talked about it including 50%, the southern 50% of Afghanistan. And so people are, I think, more aware, and there's constant violence, there's constant fighting as the U.S. and coalition troops go after Taliban, Al-Qaeda, those sorts of people. And we see that violence spreading into the cities. The explosion, the suicide bombing in Kabul this weekend was just one example of how it really has spread and worsened in many ways rather than getting better.
Mm-hmm. I was actually looking at a September 9th New York Times article. It says, suicide bomber kills 16 in Kabul. And one of the lines says, heavy fighting also raged in a strategic area west of the city of Kandahar, where Canadian troops are locked in fierce battles with Taliban insurgents. Wrote in the margin, are they? Is that, I mean, who are the people being fought? Is it all a resurgent Taliban? Is it freebooting warlords? Is it, I mean, who, is there any way to tell who are actually the opponent of the NATO forces?
Yeah, it probably is a little difficult to tell. There's a mix of people. There are Taliban. There are people who are calling themselves Taliban because it's a way of showing opposition to what they see as a failed government, a failed invasion by the West. There's certainly drug lords and criminals who have reason to try to protect what's going on, especially in the southern part. As you also may have seen, the poppy crop is up 59% over last year. They produced enough opium poppies to satisfy 130% of the world demand for opium.
Which means that it will drive the price down.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, the farmers were never the ones really profiting. It's estimated that the farmers are making 10% of this. 90% is going to drug lords and warlords and funding Taliban and funding all sorts of problems that we really don't want to see either in Afghanistan or in the world. So the fighters are a range of people. In Kandahar, I heard some people saying that the thought is that a lot of these folks are Pakistanis, and so there's this rumor in Kandahar that if the U.S. is friends with Pakistan and Pakistan's, you know, sending people in to fight and funding this Taliban resurgence, then does the U.S. really want Afghanistan to succeed? Or, you know, there's all sorts of confusion about what really is the point here. And, you know, it makes sense that Afghan people I talk to say, so where's Osama? So where's Mullah Omar? So where's this free and secure country that we were promised? You got rid of the Taliban 5 years ago, but, you know, what have we seen substantially change?
Ann Brodsky is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. She's the author of With All Our Strength. She's the director of Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Maryland. Well, Brodsky, it's not all bad news. I was just reading an article here. It says that a $25 million Coca-Cola bottling plant has opened.
Yeah, that's true. That is the good news, I suppose, if we want to take that sort of a model of spreading Western industry abroad. But what's amazing about that is this is the first major economic kick-starting that's come in from the West. There have been no other plants, no other industry that's opened. Afghanistan's importing cement from Iran and Pakistan, where they used to produce their own cement. And so there's so much of the economy that really could have been started over these years, and instead the money's sort of pouring out to other places.
Mm-hmm. Well, the NATO general, that's the commander of the forces there, the coalition forces fighting, who identified as the Taliban, said they need another 2,000 troops. This does seem a little reminiscent of the Soviets and back when in the nature of the British. Is the West capable of, this is a loaded verb, of conquering Afghanistan? And they never have been able to.
Right, and the question is, if we went in to try to conquer Afghanistan, probably not. The rhetoric was that we went in to liberate Afghanistan, to help them to set up a legitimate democratic country. And, you know, as that same general is sort of, I think he's the one who said, you know, we've lost the battle for the hearts and minds, and that's really the more important battle. Had there been economic initiatives that really made a difference, had we seen a parliament that people really could believe in, if the ministries were full of people who were, legitimate, educated, going to try to work for the best interest of the Afghan people, it would be totally different. There were young men who I talked to on the streets of Kabul who were sort of saying, well, you know, I'm driving this taxi or this car, or I'm driving for this NGO because it's the only job I can find, and I know that they pay the foreigners who work for this NGO a whole lot more than me, and if the Taliban comes and offers me more money and maybe more security, I may have to think about that. There's a lot of fear of the Taliban. There's a lot of fear of them coming back, but also a lot of fear about the security and the lack of ability to feed oneself and one's family.
Well, it must be almost impossible ever to get a grasp of what everyone thinks at different regions and what motivates them. I mean, I wonder, a country that's inundated with Coca-Cola, and also I see that mobile telephones with this Roshan company is spending about $180 million setting up there as well. So whether or not the appeal of the traditional way does have some value to people, can we force them into the 21st century? And beginning with Coke and cell phones, I don't know if that's the best aspects of what we celebrate as Western culture.
Right, that's probably not the best contribution, but one of the reasons why cell phones are so important is because the electric lines and the telephone landlines were just destroyed during the Civil War. You're out in the city and in the country, and you see street lights, but they don't work because there's no electricity. You see the high wire poles going out miles and miles and miles into the countryside with no wires on them, because those were all stolen and sold for scrap years ago. And so the reason why the cell phones have been so important is because it's a much more economical way to rebuild a phone system. But unfortunately, it's also turned into this status thing. It's turned into this thing that everyone has to have. And Afghans are, on average, making about $250 a year. So, as you can imagine, a cell phone is pretty much of a luxury. The other way they come in handy, though, I have to say, is when there's no electricity, the lights on the cell phone, when you press the button, make a pretty good flashlight.
And Brodsky, when you've been in Afghanistan, tell us a little just about your experiences. Is it dangerous for you? How are you received? How do you come and go? And I mean, your book, With All Strength, is about Afghan women. How do you gain access to them? So what just maybe a little bit of what your experiences have been there?
Well, and it's changed over the years. When I wrote the book, the organization RAWA is an underground women's organization. It remains underground. And when I was writing that book, I was living in their communities, living with them, and was really quite protected by them, but because they live an underground life as well.
But let me just interrupt and ask you, why is it underground?
It's It's underground because they have always been threatened. They've spoken out quite adamantly over their years, and this is an older organization. They were founded in 1977 by a 20-year-old college student. This was pre-Soviet, to advocate for women's basic rights and education and to provide humanitarian assistance. When the Soviet Union invaded, they changed their mission a little bit and got involved in anti-Soviet activities, all nonviolent, and then during the Civil War, they continued to advocate for free Afghanistan, this time speaking out more against the fundamentalists and these violent factions, and under Taliban, they did the same. And they continue today to speak out against the situation as they see it in Afghanistan. So they've made a lot of enemies along the way, and that's why they have been underground, continue to be. Their founding leader actually was assassinated at age 30 in Quetta, Pakistan. And in the book, what I really wanted to do was to use this is one example of the strength of Afghan women and the lengths that they have gone to, really at great peril, to continue to try to help their fellow Afghans. And I have met lots and lots of women, part of this organization, independent, part of other organizations, who really have done amazing things under such difficult circumstances. So when I was with them, I was protected in ways because everything was a secret. On my recent trips, I've gone back much more as an independent person, have been working with other organizations which aren't so secret. But nonetheless, life is pretty scary there at times. There are suicide bombings that you have to worry about. There's a definite change in the attitudes towards foreigners. My first trip back was my first trip to Afghanistan was the summer right after the Taliban were defeated, and people were really quite happy to see foreigners. They were really friendly. They were hoping that this was going to be the beginning of positive changes, and we Americans and other international coalition members were not seen as invaders. Everyone was really seen very differently than they saw the Soviet Union or saw the British beforehand. And there were quite high hopes, but those hopes really haven't come to fruition. And so this time when I was there, there was a real different feel. There was this feel that, you know, what are you here for? What do you want? You know, your country hasn't really helped. There's a lot of suspicion. There's a lot of suspicion, unfortunately, among Afghans as well, that, you know.
Well, you mentioned what it's quoted in this material I have. You talk about armor-plated Land Rovers. Is that something you have to travel in? Do you have bodyguards? Are you able to just walk down the streets?
Yeah, that's not how I live. I have enough friends there. I live with Afghan families, so I live both with the risk they live with, but also a much more down-to-earth sort of life, and I, you know, live in situations where, just like them, I didn't have electricity except every other day, maybe for a couple hours, where you sort of are at risk when you're out in a regular old car. But if you're an international person who's working for a big NGO or something like that, people live in guarded compounds. They oftentimes will check the car to make sure you're not coming in with a bomb on it. You are driving around in SUVs or in Land Rovers that have extra plating on them. People are really quite scared, and for good reason. And it's part of where mistakes happen. When I see our troops on the ground, too, they look pretty scared as well. And that's where the mistakes happen, where they hurt civilians, and civilians also are quite scared of them. For those very reasons, and sort of say, you know, these guys don't know the difference between a man in a turban who's Taliban and a man in a turban who's going to his job and is not at all the threat.
Always what happens when foreign troops are fighting irregulars. In fact, they say you can't tell the difference. And Brodsky, the instructor of our Tai Chi class collects money very frequently and has sponsors benefits for a children's school in Afghanistan. It's also had us contribute a lot of winter clothing. What is the situation with the schools? Because I know you talk about schools being burned. That's very frightening.
Yeah, there's actually there was a UNICEF report that just came out in July of 2006 that documented 99 school burnings just in the first half of 2006, up six times from 2005. Six children have been killed, and there's a lot of children who just aren't allowed in school anymore because it's too unsafe, and this particularly affects girls. We heard a lot of how the kids got to go back to school and girls went back to school. And while that was true, most of those children who were able to go back to school were in the five major provinces, and the girls who went back only make up about a third or a quarter of the total school children going back. So there was a lot of progress that one would hope would happen, but instead schools are again becoming the sort of front line of the ways for people who oppose the government to voice their opposition through burnings, through threatening, through killing teachers. There have been principals killed. And so, unfortunately, even education, which is such a basic right, is not going as one would hope in Afghanistan.
Well, speaking about things not going as one would hope in Afghanistan, it doesn't look like anything is going that way. This continuing war seems to only exacerbate the problem. On the other hand, you have the men who have created such chaos in Afghanistan for so many decades, the warlords being part of the government, and the Taliban that would reinstitute a repressive government always waiting in the wings. To my mind, I can't imagine a good solution, or am I missing something? And I don't mean to put it all on you if I can't think of it.
Well, and I have to rely also on the real strength and intelligence of my Afghan friends and colleagues there when I ask them, because when I'm there, it does feel quite overwhelming, and I have the luxury of taking my U.S. passport and coming on back here. And so I ask them, what do you need? What message do you want to get out? Where do you see the solutions? And they are saying the same things that they've said all along, which is disarmament, which should have happened before the elections occurred, but still could make a difference. Investment in the real infrastructure, investment that reaches the people instead of building these palaces and building, you know, Western-style malls, which really aren't the kind of help that the people need, and support for those democratic voices, because they exist there, but they're getting more and more scared and more trampled. And it's a shame today that request for 2,000 to 3,000 more NATO troops wasn't met. None of the NATO countries would step up and send more troops to help, do something about the violence as well.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. This is an incredible report, a first-hand one from someone who's visited Afghanistan five times. My guest has been Ann Brodsky. She's the author of With All Our Strength. There'll be a link on my page, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, to the book. She is the director of Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Maryland and also an associate professor of psychology. Thank you so much for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you for covering Afghanistan.
ATV.
Arctic ATV.
You provide the garage.
Xbox with magnets about 7 bucks.
A generator.
A narrow sound box.
We'll give you all the sweet new toys.
Computer system and car with amplifiers. So I join the signing chair.
Even smile and control to play like there.
Oh, now you're just being crazy.
W-R-I-M. It's your garage.
Head up, there's no money.
Keep listening for details on 101. Go Rare.
Measure these things that you bring. Sank into Eden within. Alone in the church by and by. I'll read to you here, save your eyes. You'll need them, your boat is at sea. Your anchor is up, you've been swept away. The greatest of teachers won't hesitate.